Ways and Means Committee for Wednesday, February 13, 2008 to order. Appreciate everyone being here. This is another Department of Human Services day. We're going to talk about those items. Some people may be confused. It says Capital Construction. That's for DD Group Homes. That's not for the University Arena. So we're not going to be talking about that today. Just to be clear, this is not University Day. This is Human Services Day. With that, we're now going to start a little public hearing, hopefully on items that are before us today on human services or anything to do with the human services department here. We have a few people that have signed up and want to make sure they get taken care of. If there's someone else and we have time, we will do that. Testimony, please, if you can keep it to about 3 minutes, so everyone gets a chance to talk, and then catch up with us afterwards if you need a little more time. Let's start with Jessica Cheney or Cheney. I'm sorry.
Is it okay if I bring the next person?
Yes, please do so. That'd be just fine.
Did you read my note?
No, I did not read that bloody note.
My little comment. That's it.
Please identify yourself and start writing.
Yes, my name is Jessica Cheney, and I'm the chair of the Family Services Review Commission. I also work for the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, but today I'm here as a past recipient of public assistance services. And I'm mainly coming in response to some testimony that you heard yesterday during the hearing, a public testimony section, rather. And you heard from a woman who shared her experience of living in a community where there were women there that she believed were on TANF, and that she thought that many of them were making poor choices, and that the TANF program was supporting them in making those choices. And I wanted to share another viewpoint on that topic. It was very difficult for me to hear those negative judgments towards people on the TANF program. It's really a hard thing to apply for TANF services, to be on the TANF program. And even years later, it's been, 15 or so years for me that I've been on the program, it's still hard to talk about because there is such a negative stereotype about the women that receive those services. And so I wanted to kind of follow up today to give another picture of people that are on public assistance, and namely myself. And I just want to share a little bit about my history, just to give you a sense. I was on the program, I joined the program in the late 80s. I was in the military for 5 years. I had two young children, and my marriage no longer worked. I moved back to Oregon. And even though I had many years of employment in my background, the skills that I developed in the service did not translate well to the civilian sector. And that was also during the recession, and so I had a hard time finding a job. And that's when I applied for public assistance. While I was not public assistance, I went through a vocational training program. It was about a 6-month program, and at the end of it, I found a job, which was a good thing, except that there were no transitional services at that time in the TANF program. And because my financial situation was so precarious, I could not even wait the 3 weeks it would take to get my first paycheck. I had to quit the job and go back on TANF assistance. Actually, back then it was called the Defendants of Dependent Children, but I'll just call it TANF for now. It's really the same program. That was a pretty depressing time for me because I felt like I had done what I was asked to do, and I was feeling hopeful about the program and about my future, and then to have that happen, it was really disappointing. And I felt like I was never going to be able to get off of assistance, and I really didn't want to get off. And I think sometimes you hear about people, for instance, it was mentioned yesterday that some people stay on the program intentionally, have more children, because they think the benefits are so rich, but that's not the case. We get so little, and it's so hard to make ends meet. And the one thing you really want to do is get beyond that phase in your life and feel more secure about yourself and your family. So during that time, there was a different climate in the TANF program, and that was that they were encouraging women on public assistance to pursue higher education. It was a bit of an experiment, but fortunate for me, I had a caseworker that thought I would be a good candidate, and so I applied for enrollment at the University of Oregon, well, actually first LCC and then the University of Oregon, and I completed my bachelor's degree while I was on public assistance. And that was a really important thing for me, because I feel like that's what really helped me to become more self-sufficient and really be a good role model for my children.
Well, I have to ask you to summarize a little
bit. Okay,
good. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, in 1996, as you know, there was a big welfare reform effort, and a lot of the services were taken away from women, and consequently, a lot of people have been left in poverty, and they haven't gotten the assistance that they needed. And I wanted to just kind of remind, I guess, legislators that some really important things happened last year during the 2007 session. New investments were made in the TANF program, and a number of new programs were added around the post-TANF program, which really is providing the kind of assistance that I needed when I got that job, which was that support for those few months until I could get stable, and also the SSI program, and now more strong upfront assessments so that families really do get to talk about what is important for their families and what avenue they want to take. And those are really important new components to the program, as well as the new climate, which is this philosophy shift towards a more asset-based approach, helping people move positively in the right direction. And so I just wanted to remind everyone that it's really a time to celebrate. I mean, we haven't made all the improvements that are necessary. We're a long way away, but we're on the right direction. And I just left here yesterday feeling like all of the good aspects that are part of that program now have not been acknowledged. And I kind of left feeling like the program was bad and the people on it are unmotivated and not willing to do good things with their life. And so I wanted to remind you that there are a number of women in which welfare really does work. It makes an important difference. It did for me, and it does for a lot of other women. So please keep that in mind as you go forward.
Very good testimony. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yes, ma'am.
I don't have a handout. I was a last-minute request.
That's fine.
Jessica, my name's Diane Cohen-Albert, and I'm also on the Family Services Review Commission, and I'm just recently retired from 28 years of being the executive director of the Insights Teen Parent Program in Portland, Oregon, Multnomah County. I'm also on the local Multnomah County Commission for Youth and Children, Youth and Family. And I worked with teen parents for 32 years, not just the 28 at Insights. So I got to listen to Jessica's computer, the testimony from yesterday, although I wasn't here. And so I did want to respond to it, having worked with teen parents for that many years. About 27% of teen parents choose to go on TANF, and many of them make that choice because they have a vision. They really want to get on with their lives. They want to finish school. They want to move into work. And they have something clear in mind that they want to accomplish in their lives. And it's not sitting in front of a TV or having another child. It really is that they want to get out of poverty and move into something and make something of themselves and be good parents. And they have something clear that they want to do, which is why they've done something scary for them, which is to go into that office and fill out those forms and take those steps that you need to take to move into being in the TANF world and have a worker and all the rest of it. So I've worked with a number of young women who have been very successful. I'm working with a young woman right now who's not so young anymore, but she has two kids and is on the staff at the local commission of Multnomah County and is a real go-getter. And she used TANF to get all the things she needed for herself and her kids and to be a success in her life. And she's a pretty amazing young woman. And a Latina young woman, amazing human being. You would all be delighted to meet her, and I wish she could be here today to speak to you. I've worked with some young women who were also in the child welfare system, whose kids were in foster care, who've used the TANF system to get themselves through school, to get their kids back, to get through, you know, to do the things they wanted to do, to learn to be better parents, and have worked with their workers. And I just want to be a voice for that, because I think hearing the negative myths that are out there can be so scary, and it's so easy to take those as the truth when in reality they aren't. They just aren't. And I think it's really easy to have those be what you live with, and they just aren't.
Well, thank you for coming forward and helping give the other side of the story. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, let's go to Sandra Asbury and Dee Heeman, I believe.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
I'm Sandra Asbury Zeitman, and I have an adult foster home, a dual adult foster home. I do DD clients, also a relative. I take care of my elderly mother. My workload is very, very heavy. We total care of their health issues, emotional issues, behavior issues. Along with my mother, we do her home hemodialysis, which her care level has increased to the point that I've almost had to think about putting her in a rest home.
Thank you.
Because there is not enough money there for me to pay somebody to come in and cover for the days that she's not on dialysis. She's on dialysis 3 days a week for 4.5 hours. My DD clients love my mom very much. They fit into our home very well. I think everybody has a right to feel what it feels like to live in a home environment. The guys I've taken lived out at Fairview for years. Then they were transferred to the state community program. From there, they came out to my house. And I got a commercial license to take in DD clients so I could stay home and take care of my mom and be with her. Inflation has really increased. I mean, you almost have to sell your firstborn to get a tank of gas. I supply their entertainment. My clients that I have are one-on-one clients, if you know what that means. They have to have one staff per client. So both of my clients are one-on-one. I have staff that I have to pay to be two staff a day. There are sometimes I have to have three staff there on the days mom has dialysis. It's just, I don't know. Welcome to my world.
Yeah.
Any one of you are invited to come out to my house to take a look at one of our days. Part of my job with even the DD, including my mom, is to get them out into the community, to integrate them into our community and what it's like to go to the grocery store, use their own money, which their concept of money, you really have to be there to support them in it. It can be quite entertaining sometimes, too. So, if you have any questions, I'm willing to answer them.
Well, thank you. Thank you for
taking what else to tell you.
No, it's very good.
Mr. Chair.
It's a real flavor. Yes, questions? Anyone else?
Yes, thank you. During the interim, I was talking to some of my folks out there, and they're doing the same thing. And the very big issue was on social service assistance. I mean, we have long distance to drive out in Eastern Oregon, and for you to take care of some of these folks, but they have to go other places. Could you sort of discuss social assistance? And then, do you have, and the second part of that is, I mean, do you interact with lawyers, judges, other social workers, probation officers? I mean, what are some of the
I handle, we have one client that has to go to mental health for counseling. I can't discuss names, but I only take in sex offenders. They are totally one-on-one out in the community. I have to take them to all the doctor's appointments. Right now I'm facing a very big dilemma with one of my clients who has very, very bad teeth, refuses to have them pulled. So I have to find out some way that since he doesn't make good choices, I can't make him pull his teeth. Right? So I have to find somebody that can tell me what I can do because it's going to make this guy very sick. I deal with a caseworker, case manager, every month that comes out to the house to check on my clients. And I do all the doctor's appointments, and yes, we do go into their doctors with them because they don't have the mental capabilities to understand what a doctor's telling them. I live in Jefferson, which is like 15 miles south of Salem. So on an average, I'd say I have 5 doctor's appointments a month between my clients and my mother that we have to run back and forth, back and forth. Also, I have to include their entertainment on things that they like to do. You know, they like to go out to eat. bowling, movies, which all requires staff to be there with them, to transport them, to be in the movies with them, you know. If lawyers are involved, yeah, I will be the one that will be dealing with lawyers or anybody else that has questions concerning my clients.
Thank you again for what you do. Appreciate it.
You guys have a good day.
You too. Okay. So do we have a D. Keeman, or did I say that right?
That's her.
Well, that's your last name. I see it's written in your husband's name. Barbara Casey, please. I'll probably not ask a lot of questions, members. If you want to get together with them afterwards, they have a pretty full agenda, very compelling stories, but let's get together with perhaps some of these people afterwards, if that's okay.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Barbara Casey, and I am a social service specialist one, sometimes known as a caseworker in Department of Human Services for Child Welfare, and I'm here to speak about SSAs. The person before was about adult foster care, so I think that's why she wasn't able to answer your question, Senator Nelson. Well, I wanted to let you know that, and something that you all know, is all the challenges that DHS has faced this past year. And my staff, of whom I'm one, have been very supportive of DHS efforts to lower our caseloads, to lower our supervisory stance, and also to institute the Oregon safety model. But it's our belief, certainly, that caseworker time with families with lower caseloads are going to produce quality results for our families. And you may know that Oregon is one of the top 15 states in terms of returning children home to families. But I do want to let you know that smaller caseloads don't reflect workload. A typical case in Multnomah County might have a mom and a dad and two children. And in the very beginning of the caseworker is establishing if there's any Native American heritage. So we're checking with tribes to check on enrollment. We're establishing if there is a legal father and how did that become legal. Paternity testing, birth certificates are looked at, support enforcement, marriage. There may be a man that she was married to but not the biological father, so we frankly have to rule him out and do a lot of different paternity testing. Caseworkers are then dealing with mother's attorney, father's attorney, child's attorney. There are certainly many of our cases, about 70% have to do with substance abuse. So caseworkers are making referrals for drug and alcohol treatment, certainly maybe domestic violence counseling for mom, anger management for father, looking for a housing referral for father, and beating the door down for residential treatment for mom, including mental health treatment for children, and looking to see if we can keep children in the same school that they're in, because a child typically, whether they are in foster care or not, loses an average of 6 months of learning if they move. And all of these things do impact. Our caseloads have gotten a little smaller, but they have become extremely complex. And into that mix is our SSAs that we feel are absolutely critical, because the SSAs, are the social service assistants, are those people that really help make that connection with children and their families, and the visits and reunification that are such a key piece. As you know, I don't want anybody to ever think that they are just transporters. They are the ultimate communicators. They are the people that help supervise and really get the kind of communication a parent client does need. Many times our plans and our jargon almost need to be translated by someone who can say, you know what the caseworker just said? She just said this. And so I will tell you how, I must tell you how important SSAs are. In addition, we're considering group visitation. We struggled with our losses of SSAs. And I will tell you, group visitations don't cut it. I can't imagine a legislature would want to see, you wouldn't accept 10 families in a room if you only had 1 or 2 hours to visit with your child, because you would need that consistency, you would need that coaching, you would need the type of one-on-one work that you want to have with your child. I kind of liken this effort, and I know it was a good effort, I kind of liken the addition of caseworkers, something like the hospital saying, we have hired some new nurses for you all to enhance patient care, but we're going to be cutting 60% of our CNAs. And I can't imagine any of you thinking that you wouldn't suffer. And so I think that truly I'm asking you to refund the SSAs, look at that appropriation seriously, and know that the line staff is in very, very serious support for our social service assistants. Thank you.
Thank you. Good testimony. Thank you very much, Barbara.
Thank you. Okay.
All right, let's get Mr. Bennett, Ms. Armstrong, and Mr. Carlson up, please. Well, those will probably be our last public testimony for this afternoon, because we have, again, a pretty full agenda that I think we need to move to. And I'm sure these professionals will be succinct and erudite to a fault.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. I'm here today to support the Department of Human Services rebalance proposal, specifically the one in the senior and people with disabilities cluster dealing with the $9.75 million community-based care rate proposal. I think this really is an issue about needing to reinvest some savings you have right now in the SPD budget to address a very serious problem that, if it's not addressed in a timely manner, is going to end up costing you a far greater amount of money later on in this biennium. We have lost a lot of access in our community-based care facilities and beds for Medicaid clients who require those services out there, and I think if this is not addressed in a timely manner, we run a very serious risk of losing further capacity in the system, which will end up resulting in higher costs in higher cost settings if this is not addressed. I know many of you are aware of this issue. I'm not going to go in more depth now, but I'd be happy to respond to questions later after Rick and Nicole testify. Thank you. Less than a minute.
That's excellent, sir. Okay. Thank you. Come back.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Armstrong, and I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and we'll try to top Jim's time. We are here to support the full funding of the community-based care rates adjustment that's proposed in the DHS rebalance. From our perspective, our case managers are often now left with the question of where do I go, and the answer often is there are not many places to go. In several areas of the state, there are no more Medicaid community-based care options, and we honestly don't have an answer for where do these people turn to. Along with that, we would support investment in Oregon Project Independence. All of you know and heard often from your constituents about the cost savings that this program provides for the state, as well as providing the opportunity for the independence and dignity of our seniors to stay within their own communities and to be able to live in their own homes for as long as possible. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Bennett.
Another person coming back. That's excellent.
I can't even identify myself that quickly. I'm in real trouble. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations, AARP, Oregon. What they said, but also I would put it in the context of the, I think you've all seen this material. A number of advocates have come together for the campaign for Oregon seniors and people with disability. The points that have been brought forward are covered in there. Being mindful of this session, both related to time and funding, the action items that we propose for this session are very, very specific, very limited. But at the same time, clearly there is a sense of urgency to do something now. And we would urge you, as Jim has indicated and Nicole has indicated, to support the department's rebalance proposal, particularly related to the reimbursement rates and OPI. Thank you.
Thank you very much, you guys. I appreciate it. But we're going to be getting into it directly. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-chair.
All right.
Will we have them come back up for more questions?
If there's any, but I think we should get through the department's presentation. That might kind of clarify things and lead us to better questions. Maybe some of those will be, your questions will be answered. All right. With that, we're going to close the public hearing, go into work session, start with Senate Bill 556 related to the Department of Human Services rebalance plan. I guess the first thing, members, any further questions on the public health information system reports from yesterday? Do we need to go into that right now, or can we dive ahead a little bit? Yes, Ms. Johnson. or Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Just one with respect to the press release that came from the governor's office today about the appointment of a special master. And I'm not quite sure that I understand how the special master will fit into some of the planning for the new facility, whether or not I understand the special master will report directly to Dr. Goldberg, but I'm just trying to understand the relationships there with respect to the construction of the physical plant.
I think we'll cover that perhaps and get the state hospital up, cool. If that's okay with you, Senator.
It's fine.
All right, well, then let's go ahead and we'll start with LFO reviewing a memo and a spreadsheet and some of the special purpose appropriation detail. Remember, we worked on a lot of this, I think it was January, passed most of the recommendations, at least initially. There's probably six areas that we still had significant questions about. I'm sure LFO will call them out in some detail. I'm hoping this is a short review since we got it in some excruciating, excellent detail back in January and focus on the issues I think will matter most to members so they can answer all the questions they need to feel comfortable. Please continue.
Thank you, members of the committee. Distributed a memo to you earlier today, both electronically and hard copy. It had an attached spreadsheet, and then we have another handout that we want to go through. We will not revisit all of the rebalance issues, just the several that you listed as ones that you wanted to revisit during the session, and then a couple other places where there have been changes in our recommendations since you considered the rebalance in January. So I will cover those pieces that are related to my assigned areas, and John Britton is there at the table to cover his areas, so we'll be working back and forth here. But working from the memo, the front page just summarizes in budget funding types and then positions FTE how the rebalance plan, as you approved it in January, compares both to the agency's budget as it came out of the 2007 legislature, and then the column on the far right reflects our updated LFO recommendation. The one thing I wanted There are a couple things I wanted to point out here. If you look at the general fund in the legislatively adopted budget, that general fund number decreases as an agency appropriation through the rebalance plan and our updated recommendation. However, that funding that is proposed to be disappropriated from the Department of Human Services budget gets added back in. Part of it goes to the Student Assistance Commission because some savings in the daycare program reflected in the rebalance. But the other piece is the special purpose appropriation that we're recommending. So if you add up those three pieces, the general fund amount remains the same. The general fund amount within the Department of Human Services budgets to the Emergency Board and to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission is the same amount as was initially appropriated for the department. So starting on the top of page two there, there were two issues in child welfare related to child welfare staffing that the committee indicated it wanted to revisit. The first issue is the 136 child welfare positions that are funded in the rebalance plan. These were positions that the agency otherwise would have been expected to eliminate based on caseload reductions in foster care and some related programs. Because of the staffing study results, which you heard yesterday, and the recent federal Child and Family Services review, the department proposed a management action to retain those positions. The cost for the balance of the biennium is almost $4.9 million general fund with matching federal funds. And as I noted, it is funded in the rebalance plan, and we continue to recommend full funding of that item. The second child welfare staffing issue was alluded to in public testimony just before this, and that is the social services assistant positions. The approved budget included a package which did some position restructuring, added a net 20 additional positions in the child welfare arena, but eliminated 78 social service assistant positions through the reclassifications. There's has been some interest expressed in restoring that. It was not included in the agency's rebalance plan, either on a temporary basis or permanently, and it's not part of the recommended funding at this point within the special purpose appropriation. But I have noted there what the cost to retain those from March 2008 through the end of the biennium is about $3.5 million general fund, and again, matching federal funds there. The next issue that was identified to be revisited is the relative foster care payments within the child welfare area. When the budget was approved initially, the intention was that those relative foster care payments would begin January 2008, but with a means test so that the payments would only be made to persons with incomes of 150% or less of the federal poverty level. The department looked at its available TANF funding, federal TANF funding, and decided that it could, excuse me, when it came out of session, the intention was July 2008 implementation with 150% means test. When the department revisited its available funding, it determined it could start it up January 2008 with no means test using the federal TANF funding that they had available and with an actual general fund savings. So that's what's reflected in the rebalance plan. Legislative Fiscal Office supported that action, but we did note that federal TANF funding in general for the department right now in the 07-09 budget exceeds the amount of federal TANF revenues that are coming in. There's been funds carried forward from previous biennium. So what we're using overall in federal TANF money, we will not have available to us in 09-11. And so we did note that, and the committee indicated that it wanted to discuss this issue in more depth during the session. Then the next section regards vocational rehabilitation services. There were two issues there. The agency initially requested a little over $800,000 general fund, which was the estimated impact of $1 million general fund that was added during the session for supported employment for persons with psychiatric disabilities. So basically what this was mental health saying, we've designed our program to spend that million, and then there is an impact on the vocational rehabilitation services as a result of how we designed the program that will cost another $800,000. So our recommendation was that not be funded. The second paragraph there under the VR services section gives a little bit more detail about what the status of that request is now. The agency has revisited those estimates. They now estimate that instead of over $800,000, it would cost a little over $200,000 general fund to do the program as currently designed. However, $233,192 to do that program as designed for the balance of this biennium. However, if you fund that, then the expected roll-up for next biennium is $2.7 million. So what the legislature funded at $1 million for 07-09 turns into $2.7 million in 09-11. Our recommendation is that the department be directed to complete that whole initiative within the $1 million that was initially funded. And they can do that. They would just ramp it up a little slower and serve fewer people than they would otherwise with more funding, obviously. If they're directed to fund it within the million, then all that needs to be done is a transfer of $170,000 general fund from the mental health budget to the vocational rehabilitation services budget. So that's our recommendation, and that's included in the numbers that you see in the totals. Under this scenario, there would still be a roll-up for next biennium, but it would be $2 million instead of $2.7 million. Then the second issue was that the department identified $2.6 million in federal funds that they had thought that they would have during the 05-07 biennium. They didn't spend it in 05-07. Turns out they didn't have the funding to spend. But in looking at that issue, it becomes apparent that there is probably will be a shortfall in vocational rehabilitation services funding generally. And on page 3 of the memo, I've identified several reasons that that has happened. The level of expenditures increased significantly at the end of last biennium. That wasn't carried forward into 07-09. There was a budget reduction in the 07-09 budget to that program area. And over time, although we're using all the available federal funding under the basic 110 grant, that's a capped grant, and so we've shifted some of those matched funds to other areas rather than just the general services, which means that if there's a shortfall in the general services budget, that then it becomes a pure general fund problem instead of the normal match, which is about 20% state funds and about 80% federal funds. So, given all that, there are some questions that we think still need to be answered, so we would recommend not funding that $2.6 million in the budget at this time, but leave it as part of the special purpose appropriation. We believe the agency needs to look at their caseload and cost estimates again, look at other federal funds that might be available. There's a possibility that other federal matching funds could be allocated later in the biennium if there were additional general fund available, and there is a maintenance of effort requirement in this program as well, which may mean that we have to put some general fund in it. But I think there is enough uncertainty about the level of funding that it's not appropriate at this time to give them a particular amount of general fund. So this recommendation would be to keep the money in the special purpose appropriation with the understanding that at some point you would likely want to allocate some of that funding to the VR services.
On page 3, we discussed the Oregon Project Independence funding. In the rebalance plan, DHS proposed using $400,000 of general fund to augment OPI. OPI was funded exclusively in the 07-09 adopted budget with funds from the OPI fund, which ultimately have their origin with the senior property tax deferral account. That it was funded at $12.6 million. The proposal in the DHS rebalance, again, was to use $400,000 of general fund. Our recommendation back in January was to not use general fund, but instead, if you chose to add money to OPI, use $400,000 from the OPI fund, which is a dedicated source of funding for OPI. I've noted here in this discussion that we presented a forecast of the OPI fund, how much would be going into it during the current biennium, how much would be going into it in 09-11, and we checked that forecast again with the Department of Revenue, and the forecast is lower still. So we will have a general fund issue with OPI during 09-11. The OPI fund will not be sufficient to fund OPI at its current level or a level that is increased through an inflationary increase. Next is the reimbursement increase for assisted living facilities. Back in January, we noted that there was a proposed reimbursement increase for assisted living facilities, commercial adult foster homes, and regular residential care facilities, totaling about $9.8 million. Back in January, we recommended that the assisted living portion of that, and I can't remember, but it was about half of it, give or take, be unscheduled by the Department of Administrative Services until there was some agreement between the assisted living facility industry and the department about how to increase capacity in Medicaid assisted living facilities. It appears that we're making some progress on that front. Our recommendation has changed in light of the general fund revenue forecast and discussions that are currently underway right now, and we're recommending for the moment that this rate in reimbursement money, the general fund, $9.8 million, be included in the special purpose appropriation. Now, if you decided to go ahead with a reimbursement increase, and this is predicated on an April 1st increase, If you wanted to go ahead with that, it wouldn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense to put it in the special purpose appropriation. But if you intended to delay the reimbursement increase until you saw what things were like in June with the DHS caseloads, with the revenue forecast, then it certainly would be a wise thing to put it into the special purpose appropriation. But as I said, those discussions are, as I understand it, underway right now.
There are two other issues that we've identified there on page 4 of the memo. The first is state data center charges. When the department brought forth their rebalance plan in January, we recommended that the $4.4 million general fund and $4.4 million federal fund in that plan not be spent, with the general fund be directed to the special purpose appropriation until those final costs were known. The Department of Administrative Services has looked at those costs and how they're allocated, and the result is savings to the Department of Human Services. And so what we're recommending now is that the new cost be included in the budget, which is $3.9 million general fund and $3.9 million federal funds, and then the almost half million general fund savings would be true savings to be kept in the special purpose appropriation against later needs.
The second new issue is related to the Medicaid management information system. We noted that the department had included about $9.8 million, which represents a one-time cost in speeding up the payment of claims for Medicaid providers who, under the new MMIS, would be able to file their claims electronically and thereby receive payments more quickly. So it's a one-time cost, $9.8 million general fund. We've added this here because we, again, under the general fund revenue forecast, wonder whether this can be delayed indefinitely. And we have the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Division ask the department about this. The answer seems to be kind of twofold. And that is, yes, it can be delayed. However, the federal government, which paid for 90% of this project, the MMIS project, may have strong objections to doing that. So, yes, it can be delayed, probably, but we run some risks there with the federal government.
So, at the bottom of page 4, there's a recommendation summary, and you can see there that with our recommended adjustments, realizing, of course, that there are a number of issues still under discussion, but with our recommended adjustments, we'd be disappropriating over $39 million from DHS's operating budget, appropriating $38 million of that to the Emergency Board as a special purpose appropriation for the department, appropriating a little over $18,000 to the Student Assistance Commission, and then appropriating $929,000 that was funded in the department's budget for the group homes for developmentally disabled as a capital construction limitation. And what we'd like to do at this point is give you another handout and spend just a couple minutes talking about what's in that recommended special purpose appropriation and how we view it in terms of, I guess you'd say, fungible money or real savings versus costs that you may be looking at later. So I'll hand those out to you.
I think that's all.
Continue.
So on this spreadsheet that we've just handed out, what we've done is on the left-hand column identify various issues that we would see as part of the special purpose appropriation. The next column shows ones what we would consider to be savings, assuming you go along with our recommendations in some cases, where there would be no later allocation expected out of the special purpose appropriation. So basically, that would be true savings against future needs, caseload needs, some changes in federal regulations, for example. You may have heard about targeted case management changes, which have a big financial impact on the department. The normal revenue ebbs and flows that the department experiences. The next column shows those items that we think that there may be some or all of that funding would need to be allocated later based on information that would come in. We've noted in the comments column where we think there needs to be more information or more discussion about particular issues. So with that, I'll just walk quickly through these. The second column starts off with the $6.5 million that was in the DHS rebalance plan as savings, adjusted for the student daycare transfer, which is appropriation to another agency. So we have a net rebalance plan savings. The next, the $495,743, is the net savings on the state data center charges. There was a request in the rebalance to backfill a previous reduction in recovering family mutual homes, and we're recommending against that. The $811,000 for the mental health supported employment initiative that I just talked about, we're recommending that that not be funded, that they live within the $1 million that was allocated to the department. And within senior and people with disabilities, then there's several technical or revenue adjustments that were made as part of our rebalance recommendations, and then there's the general fund backfill request for the Oregon Project Independence Program. So that makes up almost $8.8 million of what we would view as being savings that would be available for other uses. Then in the next column, you can see, as I indicated earlier, for vocational rehabilitation services, I think some of that amount may need to be allocated later. John, do you want to talk about the other pieces?
Sure. The other issues are $4.5 million of the 9.8 for MMIS efficiencies within the health services portion of the budget. Down below, you'll see about $5.3 million of MMIS claims payment efficiencies. And that together is the cost, the 9.8 that I was talking about a moment ago, that could conceivably be delayed except for problems perhaps with our federal partners. Below the $4.5 million is a set aside of about $1.2 million for Oregon State Hospital hearings. In January, we talked about this. This was to establish a hearings process for patients who are involuntarily medicated. They are now entitled to a hearings process, and the total funding request in the rebalance was about $3.3. We recommended about $1.2 of that be put in the special purpose appropriation until we see what the costs really are. But the point is that this is not very discretionary until we know what those costs are, because the policy is in place, the hearings are taking place, and we may need to fund them with this 1.2. It may even be higher than that, for all I know. Below, down under the seniors and people with disability, we noted back in January that there was about $6.3 million of savings that was not identified by the department and put in their rebalance plan. However, they discussed it with us. We recommended putting it in the special purpose appropriation. We've noted here to the right that DHS has identified that as a caseload contingency for their people with developmental disabilities program. So again, not necessarily discretionary at all. We have to see what that caseload does over the coming months. Again, the MMIS portion within the seniors is the 5.3, and finally, $9.8 million for adult foster home and assisted living facility rate increase. And I've noted here, defer April 1st increase until a decision to is made to allocate. Those discussions are underway right now, so obviously we would revise this as necessary. I want to underscore something that Ms. Baker said. Again, the numbers on the left-hand side are fairly discretionary. They can be used to fund other things potentially. The numbers on the right-hand side, however, have costs associated with them that may or may not materialize. We may have to allocate all of this. We may not have to allocate all of it, but we don't know at this particular point in time. So although the total special purpose appropriation is $38.5 million, the discretionary portion of it is about $8.8. We are aware of some budgetary needs that have come before us, probably not all of them, but we've asked, for example, the department to come in this afternoon and talk to you a little bit more about the Oregon State Hospital CRIPA response. They were asked to come forward with a budgetary request. It's about $6.7 million, and they are here to explain that to you. Sheila noted a few minutes ago that the SSA cost is not in the rebalance plan. That's another $3.5 million. We've had discussions, two reports before this committee in, I believe, December and January on the Children's Wraparound Initiative, about another $275 million of general fund. And undoubtedly, there are other requests as well. But I'll leave you to do the math, but 6.7, 3.5, and 0.3 are greater than 8.8. And I'll leave you.
That's pretty good math, John.
I think what I'd like to do, if it's okay with the committee, since that's basically the original rebalance, but Mr. Britton has called out the State Hospital and Children's Health Mental Wraparound. Let's go and talk about that a little bit, hand out what data we have, because, again, it all comes out of roughly the same pot of money, colleagues, and we got to make some decisions. My understanding of our last January, you can pass that out, Joe. Last January's meeting is we made some agreements. Some of these are new items. Some of these are a review of items we hadn't gone through. What I'd like to do is have discussion on these two new items, if you will, and then go through each of the items that on that original piece of paper that Sheila worked off of, you know, this one here, one by one, and see what the preference of the group is. You know, can we make these into SPAs, not fund them, or do we fund them right now and have a robust discussion? We will not drive to conclusion. We'll conclude a work session, but this won't be the final opportunity to have a discussion on this, because I think there's other people in the building that want to have some discussion on this also. Is that okay with the group if we proceed that way, get all the information out first and go through them one by one?
Yes. Sense of the group.
Okay. Sense of the group. All right. So, John, are you leading off with the state hospital piece here for us?
I think Mr. Nickel and Dr. Goldberg,
please
here.
Come up to the stand, please. Is there any opening remarks, or should Dr. Goldberg start right in? Dr. Goldberg, when you're comfortable.
I'm comfortable?
At least for now.
Yes.
I'm just kidding, Dr. Goldberg.
Glad to be here. Co-Chair Schrader, members of the committee for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services. We're going to walk you through very quickly a budget request for the state hospital to address a number of the patient safety and clinical issues in the state hospital that have been identified both by the U.S. Department of Justice investigation as well as issues that we believe we need to address to improve the quality of patient care in the state hospital. We've been working very hard. We take this extremely seriously. And what we've put together is a proposal that is based on a couple of things. It is, number one, looking to address one by one, and we'll walk you through those issues that have been raised over the last couple of weeks by this joint legislative oversight committee as well as by the hospital staff. It's been put together in such a way that we believe we can accomplish this. It phases it in, given the ability to recruit and hire staff. It doesn't all begin on one point in time, because it takes some time to begin to recruit people, train them, and actually get them into positions. So it's staged. It's really based on what we believe we can accomplish given the labor market here in Oregon. You know, for instance, we understand that there are some critical shortages in the state around nursing care. As a result, we've taken the opportunities to be able to put into place mental health technicians and others that can, we believe we can hire very rapidly, put into place, and can do a variety of tasks within the hospital that will then free up nursing staff to do nursing-related duties. With that, as an introduction, I'm going to turn things over to Mr. Nickel, who can walk you through that in some more detail.
Mr. Nickel, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Nickel, Addictions and Mental Health Division, and Assistant Director DeBruce in the Department of Human Services. What you have are, I think, three different sheets. I would suggest that we look first at the one that says Draft CRIPA Budget Request Overview. It looks like this one. What it has on the left side is a rundown, just a listing of 22 items, but 21 that really apply directly to staffing issues at the state hospital. And you'll see that we start off with a CRIPA manager. This is different, by the way, than the special master. I know that question has come up. This is a working manager position that will do nothing but track and coordinate and manage the process on the ground at the state hospital. They will report to the superintendent of the state hospital. Then the next line is 22 patient escort positions. Dr. Goldberg mentioned that we strategically plan this so that we take workload from people who are currently doing things that really are not what they're qualified to do. They're overqualified to do many of the functions that they're doing, but because we didn't have enough escort staff or therapy techs and other positions, nurses, for example, ended up doing things that nurses really shouldn't have to do. It's a way of really economizing and stretching the nursing practices when that's one of the more difficult kinds of positions to hire, and it doesn't make sense to pay someone for as a nurse to do things that are essentially clerical or mental health technique oriented. Treatment plan, 22 mental health specialists. These are generally people at a bachelor's level. They don't make the treatment plans, but they're essential to providing the services to follow the treatment plan. Quality assurance staffing. We need, as we talked in the oversight committee, an increased ability to look at data, analyze it, and then respond to that data. And these are positions that would put us in a position to do that. Supervising physician for the Portland campus. Currently, we have no supervising physician up there. This would allow us to get a much better oversight of psychiatrists and help provide consultation to them on difficult patients. We are asking for one registered nurse in the infection control and epidemiology area. 9 additional physicians through the OHSU contract mechanism that we've had for some time. This would actually be only 6 additional psychiatrists. We have in the contract enough capacity, but not enough money to recruit all 6 doctors. This would allow us to have the funds to do that, plus an additional 6 psychiatrists. They would all be assigned to the Salem campus. We are asking for additional pharmacists and 7 pharmacy tech twos. The goal here is to reduce medication errors. We're asking for a peer support position that would also help coordinate 2 additional peer bridger programs. I want to just pause for a second and just talk about that one. I think it's critical that we have people who have actually been there inside the culture of the state hospital to tell us what's going on and also to help support people who are peers who come in and help create and implement discharge plans. A clinical recruiter, which is basically human service or human resources position, is number 10. Number 11 are support staff, again, on the forensic units to take workload from nurses and other people who are overqualified to do some things that we could hire support staff to do. Roving security, 9 additional positions, particularly focused on swing, night, and weekends. A significant increase in infection control and housekeeping. It would add 26 positions, phased in, of course, over time. Allows for one housekeeping person for each ward. Right now, as we testified at the oversight committee meetings, we don't even have enough staff to cover every ward, and housekeeping staff are assigned to more than one ward. Additional mental health therapy technicians for acuity needs, phased in 88. These are all people who have to go through a CNA training process, so you can't just bring them all on at once, and there's a certain capacity that we have for training about 22 people at a time, so that's phased in through the remainder of this biennium. We need to develop 2 new nursing positions for behavioral health CNA training program. We need 1 additional training coordinator to increase the certified alcohol and drug counselor skills that we have. We've testified at other hearings that the majority of our patients don't just have a mental illness, they also have alcohol and drug dependency issues. This would help considerably in the discharge planning process and, of course, in the treatment planning process. 3 clinical psychologists would be added. This is absolutely critical to improving our treatment plans, and then the additional staff that we've requested would help actually implement that. We particularly need those psychologists on the geropsych and the head trauma units where we're not really providing the kind of detailed behavior management plans that we need. We also are asking for 2 clinical internists to deal with metabolic disorders, 4 clinical dietitians, 1 nurse recruiter to help with the additional nurses that we anticipate hiring over the next couple of years, and finally, a relatively inexpensive program that doesn't add staff, but it's an NTK nurse education process. This is basically the concept of we need to grow our own. It's just too difficult to get out there and hire enough nurses by passively accepting people to come to us, and it's a way to encourage staff who are ready to move on into a more professional kind of position, and they would be required to give us 30 additional months of service as a nurse. That's the quick run through. I'm sorry for going so quickly. We also have some reduced overtime expenses. We anticipate that shave off about $486,000, reduction in the contract nursing premium because of all of these changes. And finally, we took the formula that's usually used for administrative services division. We chopped it in less than half. I think it originally was well over $1.6 million. We looked at it position by position and felt that we could reduce that and still get all the administrative functions done.
Let's see. Why don't we go ahead and entertain a few questions right now on this, and then we'll go to children's wraparound, and then we'll come back and go to the questions on the board rebalance. Is that okay with the group?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Questions? Senator Monroe and Senator Winters.
Thank you. I have a real concern about the recommendation that we not restore any of the SSA positions.
Oh, Mr. Excuse me, Senator. I just want to do the state hospital right now.
We'll stick to them.
Yeah,
okay.
Just real quick, and we'll get back. We'll get to that.
Right.
I want to go through them in order at that point.
Okay.
Since these guys are already up here. That's all right. I apologize.
That's fine.
Suffer these guys in the hospital? Senator Winters, you're still in the queue? Okay, yes. Senator Winters, Bates, and Berger.
Just a couple of quick questions. Could you explain to us how the CRIP manager differs from the superintendent? And also, because in the report, the DOJ's Department of Justice report, there was emphasis that was placed on the lack of treatment plans. Who is responsible for developing those plans, and how does your staffing address that particular issue?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, let me address your second question first, if I could. The clinical psychologists are the key positions for drafting the treatment plans and behavior plans. It needs to be signed off and approved by psychiatrists, but the people who really work on the details of that are people who are trained in behavior management and behavior change.
So can one assume, follow-up, so can one assume that the three clinical psychologists that would be added and the metabolic disorder clinical assistant. What I'm trying to get at is if the three is adequate to do the job that is necessary in order to do the treatment plans.
Co-Chair, Senator Winters, let me back up just a second here. What we're requesting today will not solve all of the problems, and I'm sure you understand that. But the difference between trying to get at the clinical psychologists deal with behavior issues, the dietitians and nutritionists, those metabolic disorder specialists are working more on those patients who have severe physical health issues. And so there's obviously going to be some overlap. If someone has an eating disorder, they're going to need both the dietitian work, but it needs to be coordinated with the clinical psychologist. Does that get at the concern you have?
Actually, my concern is whether or not on the front end, on the beginning end, that you have the clinical psychologist who's responsible for developing the plan, and so that the rest of the system is there to implement and carry out. And I just want to be assured that, and I know we can't cover it all, but that it's adequate enough when we talk about the that it's adequate enough to actually make certain that plans become in place, because that was a huge, if I can remember the report, that was a huge issue that was raised by the feds, that we did not have in place patient plans.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, this will be about a 10% increase in the number of clinical psychologists who do that work. I think the key is not just writing the plans, but also relieving those clinical psychologists of other responsibilities so that they can focus on producing those plans. And then the other positions that we're asking for will help implement them, because it's one thing to have the plan, it's another thing to actually implement it.
Now back to the first question.
If I recall your question, it was the difference between the CRIPA manager that we're asking for and the superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the superintendent has statutory responsibility for all aspects of the functioning of the hospital. The CRIPA manager will focus specifically, work very closely, obviously, with the superintendent, but on those things that were particularly highlighted in the CRIPA report.
So is that assuming that this is once the corrections have been made, that's a temporary or a short-term position?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, yes, it's my opinion that this would be a limited duration position. I don't know that we went into that level of detail on this, but to me it doesn't make sense to have the position continue as long as we're assured that the changes that we've made continue to be there. I don't want to stop it without being sure that we've institutionalized the changes, but I would see the position as being able to go away at some point.
Senator Bates. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. A couple of quick questions. This plan you're proposing, does it have to pass muster with the Federal Oversight Committee?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Bates, we're going to be negotiating, as I'm sure you're aware, some sort of settlement agreement, something that will lay out the details of what the federal government expects. I'm really confident that this will be viewed as a very strong first step toward those things. I can't see far enough into the future to see exactly what they would request, but we've keyed, as you can see on our document, each one of these items that we've requested to one of the five major areas that they're concerned about. And we have even more detailed action plans that we'll talk about at the Oversight Committee at our next meeting that will go into more detail that will show how these positions actually fit into the action plan that is in turn keyed to the CRIPA recommendations and requirements.
Mr. Chair. So when can we expect to negotiate, after you present this plan to the feds, when can we expect to have buy-off for them or not buy-off for them and actually see some sort of a final plan that we can really look at this committee? I don't feel like I, even as a practicing physician, have expertise in this kind of an area to say this is a great plan or a bad plan that's appropriate or inappropriate. I don't have that expertise, and I doubt anybody in this panel does. That's not taking shots at my panel members. We just don't have enough expertise to make this kind of judgment. So I would rely somewhat on what the feds say about this proposal, and there's some very specific numbers here. I don't know if those are good numbers as far as get the job done or they're overkill. I just don't know, Bob. So I'd like to have some assurance the feds will be satisfied with this.
I think, if I may interrupt, I think the goal here with this proposal is it's the department's first attempt to respond to a lot of the problems that have been there. And we will be revisiting this, obviously, in June. And hopefully by that time we'll be getting a little bit more feedback on what's actually going on and be able to get a little bit more assistance. Mr. Nichols?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Bates, if I could, I will also refer you to the short-term outcomes, if you will, the performance measures that
really
we've established. That will be part of the conversation with the DOJ when we talk with them. I think that they will find this respectable. Dr. Goldberg and I were talking just before this on one of these, for example, the reducing the seclusion hours by 40%. To me, that's a fairly ambitious thing, but I don't know whether the feds are going to say, no, we want you to move much faster than that. If we could move faster than that by requesting some additional positions, then I would want to do that. I see these as goals that I think are realistic. If we can exceed them, I would be very pleased with that, and that will be the nature of our conversation with the feds.
One last question, Mr. Co-Chair. The one area I do have a feeling like it's sort of, you have a judgment on this is the number of internists you're going to be using for handling the physical health of these patients. How many interns do you plan to have at the hospital for roughly 600 patients?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Bates, I'm looking at a sheet here that I had done for me. This will increase by 20% the number of physician specialists as I see it in this particular area. My guess is that over time we're going to want to request more, but as we've talked about, this is a first request, and I think as we negotiate with the feds, we may feel that we need more. I think that adding the metabolic specialists, the dietitians, will also help with that. So I think it's a balance between the medical professionals here.
Let me interject. Another good thing about outcomes, and we're trying to learn to budget to performance outcomes and stuff, the nice thing is, I think Dr. Bates hit the nail on the head, none of us, again, not impugning anyone here, are experts to judge, is this the right mix and match? But what we do have is, well, veterinarian can look at these outcomes and say, well, okay, with whatever they're proposing, they're the experts, they're expecting to get these 50-25% reductions by such and such a date, and I'm optimistic that hopefully it comes sort of close, but that's how we can actually gauge, I think, as citizen legislators, the real performance, and then ask the real intelligent follow-up questions and hold their feet to the fire, or hopefully congratulate them on the great work that's actually being done. That's the way we should, I think, want to be looking at some of these things. Well, we have a number of people. Senator Berger, you're next.
All right.
Representative Hannah, Senator Gordon, and Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I have an outcomes question. You have a figure here on your overtime savings. And I'm just wondering, I'm curious if that figure of $486,700 is based on what it had cost you in overtime prior to this, What did you base that savings figure on?
Co-Chair Senator Berger, yes, it was based on our look at what our current overtime costs are, and then a projection of the number of staff that we are bringing in to help do things that nurses didn't have to do, and also the other overtime category. We've looked at each of the overtime categories for each of the classification levels here, so it was based on a detailed analysis. I can get more information to you, but we looked at it based on our current projections.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Bob, the numbers that you have in the budget document, the wide-page budget document on employee, the dollars shown include payroll and benefit.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hanna, yes, they do.
Just to follow up.
Please.
So they don't include, like, if I went clear to the very bottom, the nurse recruiter. That's not an office setup cost or anything. It's simply payroll and benefit.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hanna, the office setup would be in the line item for Administrative Services Division.
Okay, thank you. And one more follow-up.
Sure.
I just think that Senator Bates made a good point, so I want to stress that I like the idea where I think he was starting, and that is, and I also said on the other panel, and we're going to probably talk about this again, but to the point that before we go too far forward with implementation of this plan, that we have a pretty good response from the folks who are pushing us to get here, because it's my sense that I guess the question becomes, were we asking for these before we got the report? And that's a question that's sort of out there. I think the answer is not specifically, but if we're specifically asking for these because of the report, I'd like to know before we have to make a hard decision that, yes, we think this works, we've gotten a pretty good response from the folks who gave us the report in the first place.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hanna, one of the things that we'll be doing probably in the next couple of days is checking in with our legal counsel to see what the status of her discussion with DOJ is. In the meantime, another thing that we can do, and I think this would be a good idea to help provide you and us with some additional benchmark, we've hired, as we've talked about in the Oversight Committee, Dr. McLaughlin and Dr. Geller, and I will make sure that they see this now that we've presented it to you and get their professional opinion on whether how close this fits with what they think is coming next.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nickel, I would like to understand the approach to reducing medication errors, which is part of the high-level measures. What are the assumptions behind reducing errors 33% during the first 3 to 6 months, and then later 67% during the 12 to 18 months? How are you planning to do that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Gordley, the approach really is twofold. One is reducing unnecessary workload on nurses so they can really concentrate on that more. And then the pharmacy techs, I believe there are seven that we're requesting, are going to be much more involved in helping with the setup of medications and the monitoring of them. The quality assurance positions will also be watching the data month by month, week by week, however quickly we can gather it, and see where we're going with that. The other thing that I want to say is that I think part of what we are doing more and more now is looking at particular units, particular wards, because when you look at seclusion and restraint figures, they're much higher for some units than others, and some you would expect that. Others were, you would expect that we could focus particularly the clinical psychologists and the other the treatment planning, the mental health specialists, focus the early hires on those wards where that's the biggest problem. So I think that those are some of the ways in which we'll also approach the medication error issue.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The target doesn't seem aggressive enough. What am I missing? Why wouldn't we want to totally eliminate medication?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Gordley, I'm very happy to look at ramping that up. There's a certain amount of medication error that probably is a human error factor, and any hospital is going to have a certain error rate.
Mm-hmm.
As you all know, we're in the process of, we've interviewed for a new superintendent, and we're very close to making an announcement, and I think that person, we're looking particularly for a person with considerable hospital management experience, and I think you'll all be pleased when you get the announcement.
Well, again, I think that target needs to be more aggressive. That's my strong feeling.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Nichols, I appreciate the good work that you have done and are continuing to do. I know how serious this situation is. I understand the urgency. But just looking at the numbers attached with this, particularly when you contrast 07, 09, 09, 11, how long is this fiscally sustainable?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, I think that's a question that we're all going to need to struggle through together. I'm convinced that part of the problem, though not all of it, is the underfunding of the state hospital over many years, and I think we're going to have to grapple with that together. But at the same time, we need to expect as high a level of efficiency and professional quality from the staff that we do have. And we need to find out where both of those levels are going to be at. I think I testified before the Oversight Committee, and may have mentioned it in the meeting here yesterday, looking at other Western states and their state hospitals, we're 20 to 30% underfunded compared to them. So I think when you look at those figures, I think the expectation is that we'll need to bear some increased staffing costs over time.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Have you calculated under this scenario what the per cost the cost per patient is?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, I don't know that we've done that exact arithmetic, but we can do that fairly quickly and give you a picture of what the increase in cost per day per patient is going to be as a result of this.
That would be helpful if you wouldn't mind.
Representative Jensen. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Let me say this is something I think that's very good for us as a place of origin to something to look at and to start with. Like Senator Bates, I don't know that any of us have the expertise, nor for that matter, perhaps even if we had the expertise, want to spend the time that would be necessary to go through and come up with the figures that you have here. I am, however, of course, as I think everybody on the panel here should be, somewhat blown away by the fact that it takes a Department of Justice report threatening to bring a giant tsunami in here and wipe us all out to get us to add 211 positions to our state hospital operation. And I know that you're not pretending, nor are you saying, that 211 is the magic number that you know we need. It's the best judgment, and I accept that, and I assume, as I'm sure everybody on the panel assumes, that this is in flux, that as we go through, we get the report from the feds, as we get some history with what we're doing, these numbers may have to go up, and they may be able to go down. It's as a point of origin, I do applaud the work that you have, and it's something for us as a group to look at, to get a feel for. We will be looking at this on the other group that's looking at the state hospital. And I'm sure all of us could question whether you need this particular position or whether you should have one more nurse and one, and on type of thing. But I'm delighted with what you have. I'm anxious to hear both what the consultants that you have retained have to say about this, and I'm anxious to hear what DOJ has to say about this. Though if I were doing it, I might be more conservative than you've been to not give DOJ too much to build on, but that's just I have the luxury of not having to rest my professional career on satisfying that where you perhaps do not, you all do not. So, Mr. Co-Chair, I just want to say for everybody, my perception of it for all of you, all of us on the panel, is this is an encouraging thing to look at, even though I'm appalled at the number of people and the dollars that we have to add, no blame being put on anyone or anything for that, but just appalled at what we have to add in order, in the best judgment in that the department has, to bring this thing up to something that may approach being satisfactory for us and for the people who happen, unfortunately, to be committed, you know, there. So, in a way, my congratulations, Mr. Co-Chair, for this, and I think it's a good working document for us to work with.
Final comment from Senator, brief comment from Senator Winters.
Thank you. But I do think, and I think a lot of good work has been done, but I also think that in looking at the plan and in looking at 211 positions, and I know we've had this conversation before with the subcommittee, and that is the viability of your recruitment efforts in order to actually to be able to get nursing and some. I mean, I'm a realist, and when we put numbers here that suggest that we're going to tie them to a performance measure, and the probability, and I think we need to put that on record, that you're in a difficult position in recruiting some of the professionals that you want to be able to come to the hospital. And that's a reality, and I think the members on this panel need to understand that. And so I raise that because you need to address that, Bob, because I know, I understand that if you come back to this body and you say, you know, of the 211 positions, I've only been able to fill 100 or 150 of them. I have not been able to successfully to recruit the number of nurses that we need to be out at the state hospital because of it. And that's...
it's a very legitimate,
legitimate
response. May I ask a question? You know, members are really intensely interested, obviously, and we've identified it's going to be tough to roll things out all at once. You've told us you can't do that. Senator Winters just eloquently reiterated that. Between, and as co-chair always means, we have to balance lots of things, and we have lots of things, as we already know, in our rebalance slash human service arena. What is the amount of money out of the 6.6 you need to get you through June, get things really cooking? We're not holding it up because there's not enough money. What do you need to get to June, I guess, is a question.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, we can go back and calculate that because this was phased in, and I do want to support what Senator Winters is saying. That was foremost in our mind. We didn't want to put on anything here that we didn't think we could deliver on. You'll see that 88 of the positions are actually the mental health tech, and those, I'm told, are the easiest to recruit. And so wherever possible, we tried to pick the low-hanging fruit, and then we phased it in over a period of time. And because of the way we built the budget, we can go back and fairly quickly get you a figure for whatever you want, 6 months, 9 months, 10 months. We just need to negotiate that with you, and we'll be
happy. Some will probably be in an SBA, some you're going to need right away. It's pretty obvious.
Senator, excuse me, Representative Jensen. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I know you wanted to wrap this up, but I want to make one comment, and I don't disagree at all with Senator Winters on her statement, but I think one of the things that it's going to be a lot easier to recruit a nurse if she can figure that she's going to work a 40-hour week than it is one that you're going to ask her to work at, an 80 to 120-hour week. And the way we're staffed right now, that's many times what we're forced into recruiting into. And so if there's hope at the end of the tunnel someplace there, and that is not to say some of these are not going to be extremely difficult positions to recruit for, but understaffed, it's hard to recruit into than it is adequately staffed, I would think.
Yeah, thank you.
Coach Schrader, just in terms of the what's needed initially, we've laid out a plan that we think is going to be able to get us many of these performance measures. I think it's going to be appropriate to, in many ways, as with the other special purpose appropriations, etc., we need to know that this is going to be available if we need it. By the same token, we don't need all of it right now. As you indicated, we can't hire 50 people tomorrow. And what we can certainly do is come back, be able to say, here's what we need to get started, and then be able to come back and clearly report and say, here's the progress we've made in that first piece. If we're getting to the point that we've hired the positions that we believe we could in the first 6 months, that we've gotten, you know, many of the programmatic changes together that we needed to do, you know, it's our hope we'd be able to come back and be able to then move on to the next stages. You know, clearly, if we've been unable to meet those, which we don't believe we will be, that there won't be a need for as much additional money as we go through the year.
So the question for the committee is a pretty simple one. Is there anyone that objects to ultimately making sure, either through a direct appropriation now plus additional SPA limitation, if you will, to giving the department $6.681702 to work with to get this program off the ground? Senator Bates?
I just don't think we have enough information to make that decision. We haven't looked at all our options. I'm not seeing the cost analysis. We haven't talked about group homes and our communities at a much lower cost for these people. There's all kinds of questions unanswered here. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about these for a year and a half, 2 years, and we're going full steam ahead on building a facility that's going to cost us $400 or $500 million to buy in very quickly. It may not be adequate for our needs. We may be overrun because we haven't done our community areas first, which we should be doing first, not this first, or at least simultaneously. I'm concerned.
Okay, that's fair. Any other objections?
I'd share that.
Well, I guess let me go to Senator Carter. She had a comment, and then I'll make a statement, and you guys can chat some more.
Dr. Woodburn, are these the goals that you have prepared to answer to the Department of Justice, the federal government, problems that they saw at the hospital?
Could Schrader, Senator Carter, members of the committee, this is the beginning of that.
Right.
This is what we're... And I think in regard to Senator Bates' comment as well as this, over the last 2-3 weeks, we've been putting together a lot of work and a lot of effort, and we don't in any means, you know, come before you and say, these are the definitive goals. As Senator Gordley indicated, there are some things I think that we may want to be more aggressive on. In terms of the staffing, we certainly know that we may need to make some adjustments as we talk to our consultants and talk to the Department of Justice and do some other things. We believe this is an appropriate sort of start, and that we certainly need some of the ability to start moving this forward. But this... It's not as if we've wrapped this up and are going to say, this is it, and come back. There is a lot more work to be done. Senator Bates, you're absolutely right. We've got to look at some of the longer-term issues, community mental health. But we have some critical needs in our state hospital today, I think, as everybody knows.
That's a good one.
And we need to get started. This is a start for that.
My question was to you because of that. And that to fail to give you the dollars that to answer to the projected questions that you have to the State Department is the reason I asked that question, because if you don't have the money, then you take chances of the federal government taking over the hospital. And so giving you the flexibility to use these dollars, and that all of that is not used, come back to SPA purposes or come back stays in the system itself. And so I'm just trying to find out if this is your first stab at answering some of those questions, then it appears to me, and I won't go back to some vague statement, we're not the experts up here. And obviously these guys are trying very hard, colleagues, to answer to some of the questions, and yet we want to hold their hands by not giving them the flexibility with the dollars that they need to try to answer the questions. I don't want the federal government taking over our hospital, and I also, Mr. Chairman, don't want them, and I think one thing about, I know about LFO, they're going to be on these guys to see that the dollars are spent in a way that it was meaningful in terms of being able to answer to some of the questions. I don't understand what the problem is in terms of our not trusting them enough to try to answer to some of the questions, or if we don't allow them to have the flexibility, then the federal government take over it. Help me understand this.
Well, let's go to Representative Jensen and Representative Hanna, because I tend to concur with Senator Carter.
Well, let me say that that I tend to concur with both Senator Carter and Senator Bates.
You're in my profession.
If that sounds like a contradiction, let me you know, try to explain. I think Senator Carter is certainly correct that we've got to, and I don't know what the time elements are going to be with all of this, but we've got to provide the resources and to the department to be able to do that which is going to be required of them. Hopefully we will be able to get some sense of what DOJ has to say about this before these final check is written on that. Maybe we've got to put it and leave it to the e-board or something. We've got the certified smart people here that know how to do all of this stuff with moving money around and saving money, and let them do that for us. But I think they have to have the ability to do what DOJ is going to demand of us to do, because I know we're going to lose if DOJ takes us, decides they want to go to court with us on that. So, I agree with Senator Bates. I mean, I'm not willing to make a commitment here today to an extra $7 million for the next half of the biennium and 30 plus or minus some change for the next biennium and 45 plus or minus change for the biennium after that, until I have more information, as Senator Bates, I think, was addressing, than I have today. And I hope that even by the end of this session, that we will have a little more information. And I hope that the co-chairs and the e-board will keep their thumb on this issue throughout the remainder of the biennium, so that we're not coming back into the next session and say, oh, we just blew $20 million. I don't want to get to that position. So, yeah, I agree with both of them, and I think it's a pretty defensible position to be in.
There's no intent of, to give them a bunch of money and just walk off and say, hello, brother, and come back and find out. I think that the more prudent way is they have no intention of that. We have no intention. We're trying to be judicious. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Look, I think the thing to remember here is, whether we give them this money today or not, the shot across the bow we have in hand. It's not whether or not we hand them this money today or not. DOJ has already said, fix the problems or we're coming to participate. So whether we say today, here you go, for this specific plan or not, that is imminently in front of us. My point about this, I think what I hear Senator Bates saying, and I think what I hear Representative Jensen saying, is it's fiscally responsible because we collectively all know there's this problem. We know that we should be reserving some money out there to fix the problem. Whether or not this document or one we get tomorrow or the next day is exactly right, our point, and I think to Dr. Bates' point, what I'm saying is, let's just not agree that this is the absolute drawing of what fixes it. Let's go back to DOJ and say, we are considering these positions. This is an idea we have. Bounce it off of them and then come back in the door and say, does this work? I mean, we don't go hunting and shoot and then look for the target. You know, we find the target first. So let's make sure we're on target before we shoot with a plan. That's the point here, and it's not to disagree that putting funds aside and say, we got a problem, we're going to fix it, but let's get the target right. That's my point to this process.
So then if I may, to summarize, those are good comments, all very, very fair comments. So then maybe if I rephrase the sense of the expanded body would be that we would be okay with this amount of money as a starting point, not necessarily endorsing this particular plan and expecting the department to come back. Certainly, if it will be immediate, that's great, but certainly in June at the E-Board and report on Department of Justice's response to this to see if we're vaguely on target. Is that acceptable?
Well, no, we got a whole bunch more questions. That's excellent.
Alex, we have a lot of work to do today, and I'm willing to stay as long as every single one of you wants to engage in this process. We have some other rather controversial items, and I just want to point out that this is a process, and if we give them no money, then it will be difficult for them to move forward. We're going to be leaving. The budget process will be done in 1 week. We have lots of issues. So I just want to kind of a little contexture, little context here. We don't want to shoot the messenger before they even get a chance to get the gun in hand, shall we say. So that's just a little background comment, but we'll have some fun here. I think actually Co-Chair Nolan was ahead of the senators at this point. Do you have a comment, Co-Chair?
I do, and the concern I have, although I agree that the report and the information that we now have available makes for a compelling case for this kind of an investment, we risk thinking that either $6 million or $27 million resolves us of having to be thoughtful in planning to avoid the need for continuing to expand the population served in our state hospitals. And if we don't deal with that issue, we will forever be responding to a gun at our head. And that's not only fiscally imprudent, but it's inhumane for the people who are involved.
Thank you. Senator Grobley?
Just two comments. One, the endorsement that really matters here is that of the Department of Justice. We've got to move forward, bottom line. Secondly, we've had no conversation about those folks who may be out there considering litigation based on the findings and recommendations in that report. So, you know, if we're going to talk dollars and cents, folks, think about what those other costs that may be looming out there. And, again, we've got to move. We've got to move forward.
Well, I'm sorry, Senator Winters and Senator Bates.
I'm pretty much on the same page with Senator Gordley. One, we do have, whether we want to admit it or not, we do have the gun to our head. And it was justifiable to have it to our head because the conditions are atrocious. I think there's two things. I think we need to at least consider whether we put it in a special purpose to go ahead and to begin the work that needs to be done and so that staff can begin to say to the Department of Justice, this isn't the final. This is what we're working on. This is what we're beginning. And I think it says something else. It also says to the patients and the individuals in our institution, we haven't talked about them. We've talked only about our response to the Department of Justice. And we haven't talked about the staff.
That's right.
But it also says to them that we are going to do something about the issue. I think it's kind of interesting that, we may be revisiting this a lot of times. It's no different than what we, and I think the staff can probably weigh in, the revisit of Fairview Hospital. And when the Department of Justice came in and said, you will, State of Oregon, and comply. And that has taken years. You know, everything wasn't done in one blush. Everything wasn't done in one meeting, and I think the same thing will happen here. But I do think that we really do need to respond in a way that the Department of Justice recognize that we are seriously working on it. And that means if we take the dollars and put it in a special purpose, and so that they can draw on it as they need it, but we really do clearly need to say, not only to DOJ, but to the patients that are there and to the staff that are there. And I don't know how many of you have been following the events in the paper, or how many of you have ever went out to visit the state hospital and to actually see the conditions at the state hospital. It's abominable. And I don't want to in any way give anyone, and listeners who are listening, that we're going to delay while we wait on dotting our I's and crossing our T's, because we're going to have to do that along the way anyway.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Bates.
Sort of wrap this up if I could, because I sort of started a hornet's nest here for you. And I'm going to walk out in the hall and have my two good friends, Dr. Goldberg and Dr. Nichols, and beat the heck out of me when I get out of there. So, you know, you understand what I'm talking about here. You know, we do have a gun to our head, but it's no reason to panic. We want to do a careful job. I think my good colleagues in the House have spoken to, and what the co-chair, no one's spoken to, is exactly right. And also what my good friends right here did. We need to move forward. We need to move forward carefully and thoughtfully. We don't have to do it slowly. We have to talk to the public, and we have to talk to the staff, and we have to make sure DOJ is there with us. And I've been through these negotiations on the Oregon Health Plan, and I was surprised how we thought we had the right plan, and we went to them, and they had other ideas, and we had to go back and forth a few times. And I assume, from what you had said, Mr. Co-Chair, that you were thinking about a special appropriation for this money now, and then reviewing it in June. From what you'd said earlier, I was surprised when you asked for us to move forward directly on it. So I'd be much more in favor of a special appropriation, find out what they need to keep this project rolling forward for those negotiations and discussions right now in June, and then release whatever is necessary in June to complete that part of the planning so you can start the big job, which is changing how that hospital works. So thank you for your time, and I just think we need to clarify some things. I still think the half an hour discussion is worthwhile. Let's take the time to get it right and do it right, and we'll all be, I think, ahead in the long run.
Sure, we'll be in wonderful shape before we leave here. Oh, thank you. I appreciate that, actually. Very much.
Mr. Co-Chair, may I interrupt?
Yes, please. You won't be the first or the last.
As my recollection is that some of these positions in this plan begin in May. Is it your wish or your thinking right now that for the most part, most of this money would be put in a special purpose appropriation except for what the department needs most immediately? Is that...
That was my suggestion, but if we could get the information from Dr. Goldberg, and then we'll have an opportunity to make a final on that at least for February 2008. All right, well, we're going to... Oh, yes. Excuse me. Record from Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. I have a clarifying question. In the assumption that whatever we allocate to the department for this purpose will come out of the so-called discretionary amount there, the 8.7 and change...
Well, we're not sure if it's 8.8 or what it is. We have an opportunity to work on that. But, yes, that's the original expectation.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen. Dr. Goldberg has to go to another very important meeting, so if he's not here for the rest of the evening, it's not because he was offended or because of our intense questioning. He would love to stay here and get more intensely questioned, but he has to actually leave.
He's uncomfortable.
Yeah. It is another fun thing to go to, unfortunately. Actually, less fun than this, if you can believe it. All right, with that, let's go back to the original sheet that Ms. Baker provided us. This one, if I may call it. Yes, Senator Monroe. Let's go back. The first question, so to speak, and I'll frame it one way, and we can reframe any way you would like, but has to do with the child welfare staffing As you heard, even though child welfare caseloads are going down, there's been a report about possible staffing insufficiencies and ways to deal with the caseload. So the department has elected to use some of its rebalance money, $4.8 million, to increase child welfare workers, even though caseload is going down. But there is a discussion that they did not do anything with the SSAs, as we affectionately call them. And do we want to add all that back in into our special purpose appropriation? Do we want to make a direct appropriation? Do we want to have the department and our staff look at a mix and match of SSAs and child welfare workers and see what the costs are there? Senator Monroe, take it away.
Thank you. Yes, I have a concern about this. Under the current system, our caseworker really is the person that's responsible to investigate child abuse, drug use, whatever it be, and to recommend to the court that those children be taken away from a family and put into foster care. So in essence, the caseworker becomes the bad guy, the arm of the court, so to speak. The SSA then, who costs less than a caseworker, they're less skilled, they are paid less, is the person that then acts as the ombudsman, the go-between, that picks up the children, takes them to the mother for their supervised visitation, and so on, and is therefore is viewed by both the mother and the children as an ally in most cases, as somebody that they look to, that they can rely on, that they can trust, and so on. And so I really believe that using caseworkers to replace SSAs for that kind of responsibility not only doesn't work, but it costs more. And so I would favor a restoration of at least some of the SSAs. I realize what you were trying to do last year when you cut them out to replace them with additional caseworkers to reduce the overload on our caseworkers. I understand that was an admirable goal, but I think by eliminating the SSAs, we've really made blown a big hole in the system in terms of the way it works best for the parents who ultimately want to get restoration of their parental rights, and, you know, for the whole system.
Okay, good comment. Further discussion? Yes, Representative Edwards.
I was wondering if we can hear from the department on how the reduction in SSAs either plays into or does not play into the current transformation plan. It was my understanding that, based on yesterday's discussion, you were reconstituting the way that you divvy up workload, not by caseload, but by activities. So I'm curious if you know, this actually, you know, to what extent you think this is an issue.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Edwards, for the record, my name is Brian Johnston, Assistant Director of DHS. It's a huge issue. We have we just completed McKinsey's staff caseload workload study that showed a gap of 24% to 37% in our inability to do the work. If you take all the resources, and they measured that with the SSAs in place, with 78 functioning SSAs in place, and determined that we were facing a gap of between 24% and 37% in the inability to do that work. And if you recall, this follows just last week the release of the federal report that documented our inability to do the work and our inability to stay current on the cases. The SSAs perform a very important function, as Senator Monroe was just summarizing. And I would point you to one statistic from that study. They identified a number of factors and talked about how much they increase or decrease the work. So if the average case was one, what's a case where the parents are in court? That's a 1.35. What's a case where both the mother and father have been identified? That's a 1.4. What's a case where an SSA is helping? That's a 0.7. In other words, that case is not a full case because the SSA relieves 30% of the work.
As long as you're there, let's follow up.
Yes, Mr. Fisher, actually just a comment. So I'm not quite sure how to answer your initial question. I share Senator Monroe's concerns, but based on our discussion about the state hospital, if we set aside the 6.7 or whatever we ultimately allocate to the department for that purpose, out of the so-called discretionary figure of 8.8, then we have only $2 million left or so. So certainly we can't fully restore those positions. So I'm not quite sure what to recommend, whether we recommend looking at a mix and match or restoring the positions that could potentially be restored with the additional, you know, with the remaining dollars. But we don't know, we're not even sure the $6.7 million is what we're going to ask for in the end anyway.
Excellent point. Someone can do math. That's very good. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm not going to try to do math. My question is about outcomes. We like to make sure that children can stay with their families as long as it's a safe place to be. So there's a certain amount of effort that goes into keeping kids in their families. And for those children who can't remain with a parent for at least a while, they end up in foster care, and that's a different kind of effort. What are the outcomes we're looking for? Are we trying to keep more kids in their homes, or are we just trying to do better with the kids who we placed in foster care? And as we shift, whether there are more in their own homes or in foster care, how does that impact the costs in other parts of the agency? Because it speaks to the where the investment is paying off.
Co-chairs, Representative Nicholson, the number one goal under my administration, which is now reaching a grand total of 3 months, is to reduce the number of people who come into foster care. Those who do come into foster care, to ensure that they only stay there the length of time that is appropriate. So it's the right child, the right amount of time, and then the right return. And yes, there will be a significant savings if we can reduce the number of children who have to go into foster care. There will be a significant saving if we can reduce the amount of time that children spend in foster care. I would quote to Representative Nathanson a study that just came out of Portland State of the Christie Receiving Facility up in Portland. That's an expensive facility for us. But by placing a child there and then finding the right placement for the child, so using that 5 to 7 day or even 10 day window, and then finding the right placement, the study reported that we were getting children, compared to a control group also in Portland, out of foster care much quicker and saving money for the program.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please.
So that sounds like really good information, really good news. I am making the conclusion that improving the effectiveness of caseworkers by also having SSAs, I'm making the conclusion, correct me if I'm wrong, that also contributes to more successful and shorter stays in foster care and moving children back into homes. Is that correct?
Co-chairs, Representative Nathanson, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Is it possible that we would do or get the same work done with more SSAs and some form of a reduction of caseworkers to try to balance this out at least temporarily? I know the McKenzie report said we're probably short. Even with all, if you were able to implement all the improvements the McKenzie report suggested, you'd still be 10% or so short on caseworkers, and they did that with the SSAs already in there. Would anyone look at adding more SSAs because they're less expensive to augment our caseworkers and then not having to hire more caseworkers or even cutting the number of caseworkers back in an attempt to balance this budget out? The co-chairs are trying, I believe, to balance a budget here, and they've got a couple of real tough places to try to do that, and this is one of them. And the question is there any way within your own budget we can get this done?
Co-chairs, Senator Bates, first of all, I wish the co-chairs well, and I hope they don't choose to balance it by my program. Secondly, Senator Bates, McKenzie's not done. We identified 18 things, 18 steps that we can take to close the gap between current working at 100% and the work we have to do. Of those 18 items that we've identified, only one of them was adding staff. 17 of them are other steps that we can take. McKinsey did suggest, however, that if we were successful in most, not all, it didn't have to be all, but most of those 17 steps, that we would still have a gap. Now, the next portion of the study, Senator, may well include the pieces that you're talking about. Is the composition of the workforce amenable to achieving an additional closure of the gap? That work is ongoing and could result in some significant savings, as could, when Representative Nathanson was asking me questions, as could additional case reductions as we go forward. It may well be at the next rebalance we come to you with a significant, we're not asking for any new caseworkers today, we're just asking, leave us be, so to speak, and we may come to you with a new theory as to how we can close those gaps without additional staffing.
We've just gone through a situation at State Mental Hospital with DOJ coming in after a report that was pretty damaging. You're going through a similar report right now. In your opinion or your judgment, do you have any concerns that you'll be talking to DOJ next?
Co-Chair Senator Bates, I can assure this committee and do so with confidence that we will not be penalized by the federal government for failure to make it, because we will make the improvements necessary. The next step is that we have to negotiate how much we will improve, and then we have to meet those improvement goals. And I feel confident that there's a renewed sense of optimism inside all of child welfare. This study has demonstrated to them, to the workers, the line workers, that what they have been saying for years is accurate, and that what we have to do is redesign some approaches. We have to rethink what we're doing. We have to be smarter. I just came this afternoon from the Child Welfare Program Managers meetings, and there was a sense of collegiality and cohesion going forward. There was, I have to admit, there's some dashed expectations. There was some segments of the state where they thought that we would go with that, with a study that had the results that this one looks like, and come and wave it to you and say, give us more staff. But that's not what we're saying. What we are saying is, give us time to make it work. If you take away things from us, we will have greater difficulty achieving that.
Yes, Representative.
I'll be very brief. I don't understand your last comment, if you say if you take it away, because I'm reading this. We added 20 net positions. Right, to the in the reclassification and the SSA switchover. So we have some people working in double filled positions, and we had 20 net positions. So describe the taking people away part.
We had in 2007 when the session closed, you had added supervisors, you had added caseworkers, and we were on notice and had agreed to reduce by 78 the number of SSAs. And I'm sorry, I thought you...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And we began to give notice to that effect. Although we took no managerial action to end those positions, a number of workers did move from those positions, approximately 50. Then some individuals backfilled, and we temporarily filled those slots. And when we conducted the activity study that is this child welfare staffing study, we had 78 SSAs operational. And that's what the study is based upon. So when I say takeaway, I'm talking about taking away from the resource that was studied.
Thank you.
Good. So I guess what I might summarize is that we're interested in some SSAs being restored, looking at, is there a balance between that and the caseworkers? We have not landed on a magic number. Perhaps we'll continue this discussion and try and come back with something for the committee that meets their level of concern.
Senator,
thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Since I started this, can I just wrap up?
Yes, please.
If you remember, my initial comment was a restoration of at least some of the SSAs. I understand the budgetary constraints, and I understand the need to balance the budget and so on, but I think we need to move as far as we can, because eliminating these SSA positions just doesn't work. It's not efficient. costs more in the long run, and it certainly delays the restoration of these children to their families.
We'll put LFO and the department to the test here. Next item, child welfare road of foster care payments. This one, I think, was largely at my request. The department has seen in its wisdom to go ahead and actually ignore the means testing requirement for this initial outlay of funds. Hopefully at some point in the future, depending on what our forecast is, we'll have the opportunity to revisit that. Yes, Senator Johnson.
I know, Mr. Co-Chair, that you're trying to move us ahead, but that's an issue I'd like to touch on. What was the rationale behind that decision?
That's a very good question, because I was rather irate at the department over that particular issue.
And young Mr. Johnston has fled the room.
That was probably a good strategic move. You'd say these guys don't know what they're doing. They're very good at it. Yes, Sheila can probably lend some serious comment to this. Ms. Baker, please, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, the background of the discussion during session in the Human Services Subcommittee was that at that time, many of the members of the subcommittee were interested in not having a means test for relatives that were taking care of children. The issue seemed to be that, first of all, to set up a means test would require some additional administrative front-end work, and whether the population that would be receiving the payments, whether their incomes were such that it really made sense to do it, and that by not making payments to all relatives that you were in some sense discriminating against those that had higher incomes, even though with those higher incomes they may or may not be able to care for the children without subsidies. So I think it was a policy issue on that level. What the subcommittee eventually landed on was in the budget to fund it starting July 2008 with the 150% of federal poverty level as the means test, but directed the agency to look at whether they'd be able to come back in and fund that earlier or without the means test if they could. And so that's why the department came back with this plan.
Director, Subdirector Johnson, to come back and answer that in any more detail.
May I respond, Mr. Co-Chair?
Please.
I understand the rationale, particularly the cost of setting up some kind of a means testing, but I can't support the absence of a means test. I think that we all could serve more people were we not serving people who were not truly in need of the services. I just have a really hard time with that.
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, my apologies. I was on my way to the other meeting, but anyways. I understand now what we're talking about, and to respond, I would say two things. First of all, I think there's a fundamental misperception that has to be corrected, and that is that this money is for the parents or the family. It is money for the child. And if you begin to talk about a means test, then we're going to have to probably, we have enough lawyers in the room who can advise me, but I think we'll be in violation of federal law, because we will be means testing the others too, not just right now all we're talking about is the 657 Oregon families that have begun to receive this who had not previously because they're relatives. We've never mean tested the other people who are on foster, providing foster service, because the money is not for the adults in the house, the money is for the expenses of the child. So if you're means testing the child, all children have relatively the same amounts of income. Relatively. I mean, I know some of you have trust funds. But my point is that and now as to the means test, I know the legislation passed that way, and we did not contemplate, once we saw that we had enough money to do it, we did not contemplate putting it in. What I did do is I authorized a letter to go to the 657 people, and actually it turned out to be
slightly under 500 for reasons that I don't recall off the top of. Slightly under 500 recipients got a letter from me asking them if they would voluntarily, because I don't have legal authority to impose this, but asking them if they would voluntarily tell me a number of things. How many people are in the household, if they have more than one foster child, and what their income level was. And I said 0 to 20, 20 to 40, 40 to 60, 80 to 100. So far, and I just sent this out. As you know, we've had one cycle of this. I just sent this out. I've received 49 responses of this thus far. Of those 49 responses, nobody makes over $100,000. Six people made between 80 and 100,000, if I remember right. The vast majority of people, 25, made between 20 and 40, and something like 15 were between 0 and 20. That's where I was.
Thank you. That's good information. Further discussion? Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate your coming back. Very kind of you.
Is that leave?
Sure. If I was you, I would. Let's go to the next item on the agenda is vocational rehabilitation services. Ms. Baker's gone over her recommendations, encouraging the funding to be done within the $1 million general fund appropriated. Further discussion. We'll take that as that's okay. Next item is the Oregon Project Independence. The department sought to add about $400,000 general fund to the 12.6 that came via the senior tax deferral account. And then LFO is suggesting that since we're going to have a shortfall in that account next biennium, then maybe we would not want to add that $400,000 at this time. Discussion. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Burton, what was the original governor's recommended budget in OPI, $16 million?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Hanna, I think it was 16.6.
Follow up, please. So, the way you describe this in the paragraph, I mean, a shortfall within that fund means you could still put the money in there this year and provide the services. Is that right or wrong?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Hanna, yes. The latest forecast from the Department of Revenue of the money that's going from the senior property tax deferral account into the OPI fund for the current biennium is now about $16.9 million. It had been, when we constructed our budget, $21 million, and the co-chairs were hopeful that we'd be able to continue to use that money on into 09-11. So we're right now down from $21 million to $16.9, and we have committed $12.6 right now.
The goal is to try and build, if I may, as the co-chair said, build some sort of sustainability, and we certainly didn't expect the senior deferral going down. I think, if I may speak for the co-chairs, we're committed to trying to make sure that that is not a limiting factor next session. We'll be able to make at least the 12.6 and hopefully more next session, unless there's a huge decrease in the revenue beyond what we're seeing right now. That was the rationale. We had Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrader. Mr. Bitten, there appears to be a projected 60% reduction in the senior property tax deferral revenue. Is this just a really bad prediction, or was it? Is there some change in that has led to that?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, it's not my projection. It's coming from the Department of Revenue. And what they said was, first of all, they believe deferrals, that is, the amount, and I may get this wrong, but the payments to counties on behalf of seniors who have deferred paying their property tax has gone up. They said they examined participant records and preliminary district-level 2007-08 property tax data reveal that this growth appears to reflect higher taxes resulting from unusually large new local option levies and bonds imposed by local taxing districts, particularly in the Portland metro area. That's part of it. The other part of it is that they are predicting lower repayments into the senior property tax deferral account. They are not certain of what's causing that, but they believe that the time period is coincident with a significant slowdown in housing activity, such as participants selling their home or refinancing their mortgage. So it is possible that certain program participants who might have otherwise sold their property and paid their balance in interest into the senior property tax deferral account have not done so because of these housing market conditions. But they are quick to note that that is kind of a speculative rationale. They're not certain about that one.
So essentially the speculation is we've been robbing elderly Peter to pay unidentified Paul. The second thing I'd suggest, Mr. Chair, is the SPD budget. In general, it appears that most of the Emergency Board Special Purpose Appropriation has been appropriated from the SPD budget. It would appear on the last page of the Human Services Budget Reconciliation Bill. The seniors and people with disabilities, there's a $17.5 million reduction there. And if you go to the other page, it looks like it's close to more closely $30 million has come from the SPD budget. And I was wondering if we could have a discussion of the purpose behind that and the wisdom of it.
Well, as co-chair, my view would be is because we're trying to restore services to seniors. The way you should look at this is that this is something that the department, I believe, and we have identified as a need that may have not been fully addressed during legislative session. You don't see a lot of other human service programs benefiting from the fact that currently at this point in time it would appear that DHS in February has the opportunity to fund a few things that they did not fund before. The discussion is, do we do it outright without knowing what the final caseload is, or do we put it in a special purpose appropriation? So that's actually what is going on at this point in time. It's actually, I think, looking at children's and senior services like we perhaps did not at the legislative session.
So if I may, is there any guarantee that once it goes into the E-Board Special Appropriation Budget that it will ever get back to SPDC?
Sure. And that's a very good question. That's germane to this whole discussion we're having here tonight. And there's two or three ways to go about it, and we'll get at that in the very next item with the assisted living allocation. We can either make a direct appropriation right now because they need it to at least get the system going, or like we talked about with the children, a certain amount at a certain point in time, or with the state hospital, same issue, same discussion, or we can say, well, we want to get you enough, but we need some more information. We don't know what the caseloads are going to be. We had great testimony, I think, at one of our previous hearings from Senator Winter, Senator Gordley, and Senator Carter about we don't know what the caseloads are going to be. Usually the economy goes down, the caseloads go up. And probably none of that is in here. None of that is in here. We're looking at stuff from several months old. And so the question in our minds as prudent, you know, guardians of the public trust in these programs, do we make very definitive allocations now, set department on a certain track, and people's expectations on a certain track without knowing the final word? Very germane to what Representative Hannah and Senator Bates were talking about with Oregon State Hospital, and that's what we're trying to talk about here. And my guess is it's some mix and match thereof, and hence the discussion we're having right now. Yes, Senator Berger.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, that's well and good, but you know, I think that the legislature as a whole body really likes to make decisions. I think they like to make as many decisions as possible rather than always deferring it to a small group such as the E-Board and continuing to have any decisions delayed because of that. I really like to see everybody be able to participate in major decisions.
Very good. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate the desire to have this all be cut and dried and done with. But I would caution my colleagues that it isn't just the caseloads that are an elastic piece in this. The revenue also is. And we don't know when we get the next revenue forecast what's going to happen. It is historically, I think, the most unstable revenue forecast because it deals with all of the tax collections. And given the environment that we're in right now, I think it's pretty clear that it's going to be down. The question is, how much is it going to be down? And so not only do we have to deal with the uncertainty of what's happening with caseloads as we go into a lower level of economic activity in the state, but we have to deal also with the issue of how much money we're going to have to react to it. And so I think that the problem with trying to answer every question definitively at this point is that there's a huge amount of uncertainty, and we don't have any idea what the degree of uncertainty is. I would very much advocate on the side of being prudent, of keeping our powder dry in anticipation that what we could be seeing later in the summer might be not only significant increases in caseloads, but also significant decreases in revenue. And I think we need to maintain a degree of flexibility in order to deal with that.
I'm going to take up this a very exciting point to leave our current discussion. I've been informed the House members have other things to go to, so we're going to go to the grants and make sure, because those are work sessions we can actually get. Let's just get the grants done. We're going to recess the work session on 55.
House members of the Ways and Means Committee, you're going to lose a quorum if we don't take action on the things that need to be voted on.
So the ones that actually have to happen tonight are the grants. So
okay.
We're discussing this in some detail. So I'm going to ask just a quick recess on that, and let's go to the grants and get those out of the way. Then if our House colleagues will stay valiantly with us past our normal adjournment time, have to go, we can continue to discuss the other things.
Are you okay with that?
Is that
what
I'm
going
So who's coming forward to present the Department of Human Services Federal Grant Application Well Integrated Screening and Evaluation for Women Across the Nation program? Welcome.
Good evening.
Thanks for your patience.
Good evening, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Coulomb, Department of Human Services, representing Public Health Division. Public Health would like to request permission to apply for two federal grants. The first one I'll discuss is the Well-Integrated Screening and Evaluation for Women Across the Nation, otherwise known as WISE Women Grant. This federal cooperative agreement is available for up to $3.25 million for 5 years. The timing of this grant, of course, is somewhat early for us. We are still in the process of developing a lot of the details of the grant, but I can share with you some of the preliminary discussions we've had with our community partners. The purpose of the grant is to decrease the risk of heart disease and stroke among low-income women by promoting early detection and prevention. WISE Women would extend preventive health services to women who participate presently in Centers for Disease Control National Breast and Cervical Cancer Screening Early Detection Program by providing access to additional health services to determine risks for heart disease, stroke, and help reduce those risk factors using different behavioral changes. The preliminary goals that our program has outlined with our community partners would be to provide services to as many women as possible, eliminate health disparities by serving those that are most at need and at risk, decreasing heart disease and stroke factors in the WISE Women population, and maximizing the number of settings through providers that can deliver the services that are most needed. Some of the services that would be provided would be for stroke risk assessment as part of a screening visit, reimbursing for additional screening services and referrals, as well as including blood pressure monitoring, glucose, blood mass, body mass index, smoking behavioral cessation, and personal and family medical histories. This particular grant does have... This particular grant does require a 1-3 match of approximately $216,000 per year. Many of our community partners, however, such as the Lung Association, African American Health Coalition, local health departments, and women's health centers, are coordinating with us to determine how we could come up with that match. Under no circumstance would we commit state general fund to serve as this match, nor would we be requesting for that match. If the match was not attained by the time the grant application is due or by the time grant awards were announced, we would decline. The application is due March 17th.
Very good. Thank you. Questions? Concerns? Motion to accept the...
I move that we authorize the department to apply for this grant.
Very good. Further discussion? Seeing none? So ordered. You did a much better job than Department of Human Services.
It is Human Services.
Well, you're doing better than they did.
We need them.
Our next item is a federal grant application for pandemic influenza competitive projects.
Thank you again, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Again, this is a competitive grant that is for the pandemic influenza proposal offered by the Centers for Disease Control. This grant, too, is also due March 17th. In response to this, the Centers for Disease Control targeted $25 million of pandemic funding into what they now call a special project of national significance. With this particular funding, Oregon is eligible as part of the regular emergency preparedness cooperative agreement under AA-154. The initial proposals that we are working with our community partners and our counties is that Multnomah County presently has a community engagement project, what they call Community Pan Flu 101. They would propose putting together a more complex conversation that would involve the social and ethical scenarios that would be played out in the event of a pandemic, and how, you know, the compelling human needs would have to be weighed in an existing situation where there are scarce resources. Another situation that we would be pursuing would be to potentially involve an electronic laboratory reporting that the CDC is pushing all states to pursue, and this would allow us to basically provide secured, encrypted information under what's now called a FIN-MS, if that stands for Public Health Information Network system. And this secure messaging would allow test orders to be received and or transmitted to CDC so that they could then monitor the rise of the pandemic if it were to occur. Another option of this here proposal would be for electronic death registration, which would allow the state registrar, in partnering with that FIN-MS system that I just described, with which to be able to report to the CDC the cause of death and the fact of death in a very timely fashion. Right now, most of that information would have to be handled through facsimiles or other electronic means by which there wouldn't be a central repository. Another proposal on this demonstration project would be for Multnomah County on behalf of our Health Hospital Preparedness Region 1, and where they would then propose building a system that the health system's surge capacity would then be evaluated in order to be able to maintain and deliver services to populations in the event of a pandemic. And then lastly, another sample project would be that from Lane County would, in concert with our Office of Multicultural Health, would like to be able to provide intervention strategies to at-risk and vulnerable populations. Some of that type of strategy might include dissemination of information on lessons learned on how to access service or how to be able to take health care precautions, particularly to the marginalized communities, and how to be able to make that information available to them in both a useful and respectful manner. Another element that is very useful in our particular demonstration project is that they would work with different organizations on business continuity planning so that in the event that if their workforce was out from the pandemic, how they also would provide these services. Again, the application is due on March 17th, and there is no match required for this grant.
Thank you. Discussion? Yes, Senator Carter.
Thank you. For the first time in 24 years, I would be an absolute no on this. Senator Berger and our whole committee worked hard. The public health department said no. We tried to get some money from you, the legislature, for trying to get some money in advance and to be on notice with the federal government in case of a pandemic flu in this state. Our work went down the drain. Senator Gordley worked very hard in Multnomah County and had all kinds of focus groups and everything else, and the health department was so short sighted they didn't do anything. Absolute no from me.
Okay. Senator Gordley, have a comment?
I'm of the other opinion. That's not really a moment.
That's fitting with tonight's work so far, so it's okay.
Actually, I'm pleased to see the proposal, and this is something that we need to go forward with, in my opinion, and I think that Multnomah County is providing models and cooperation with different communities and pretty much leading the way. So I would strongly support the proposal.
Okay. Further comments?
Bates.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Bates.
I'll make a line out of one of my favorite movies. I'm with them. I just got a letter that I'm going to the woodshed from these three ladies. If I start behaving, so how do you want me to behave here? Give me a little help. Okay.
So at this point, motion.
I move that we authorize the department to apply for this grant.
Very good. Further discussion? Senator Carter is an objection. Any other objections? Seeing none, it's ordered. Thank you very much. Before the House goes, if there's indulgence, I think another super quick item, which is the capital construction on developmentally disabled group homes. I believe that's a quick item. And then
you need action on that?
We actually need action on that. For inclusion in the bill. So if I could open the work session on 5555, developmental disability group homes.
And I can address that.
John, thank you very much, sir.
Mr. Co-Chair and members, Senate Bill 5555 is a capital construction bill. What we are proposing, and we discussed this in January, is to use $929,000 of general fund that the department wanted to use, and we concur with them, to work on two new group homes. But in order to do that and to put it into the capital construction budget of the department, it needs to go in the capital construction bill. So we are proposing to disappropriate $929,000 from the operating budget of DHS and put it into the capital construction bill as an appropriation back to the department. It is a technical adjustment, but we would hope that you would approve that this evening so we can move ahead with that amendment.
It's not any, it does not lower our available resources.
No.
This is not taken out of the rebalance.
The rebalance numbers that you have reflect that disappropriation. Yes.
But making this appropriation means that $900,000 is not available to other discretionary items, and we're already overspent.
It's not in the discretionary amount, Madam Co-Chair. It's not part of the $8.8 million.
But it's part of the $38 million.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, actually, the total disappropriation I think is about $39 million, and of that, $929,000 would be going in back into the DHS budget, but for these two group homes. And those two group homes are going to be presumably destroyed in the construction of the new state hospital. They are currently on the state hospital lands, and we need capacity, and so that money was proposed by the department to be used for that specific purpose. So we're not recommending a change in the purpose. We're simply saying, let's put it into the capital construction budget.
If the coach would like to revisit this another day, I'm fine with that.
My sense is that this is a high priority, but we have talked about several high priorities tonight, and we have others yet to deal with in this budget. I think we'd like to include it, but I don't know that we...
Senator Johnson,
yeah, no final.
I, again, not knowing the intricacies of the DHS budget, are these two functioning group homes that are serving people right now?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, yes, they are.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair?
Sure.
And so we're tearing down, I think you just said we're demolishing two group homes that are currently servicing people in order to make room for the footprint of the new hospital. But we're continuing to work around that disastrous old building. and not tearing it down. And I'm just trying to understand the logic of how this is working.
Well, maybe rather than answer that now, let's have another fun-packed hearing in a couple of days, and we'll get to that. That's a very fair question. That's a very fair question. Okay. So we'll adjourn the work session on 5555. We'll bring it back at a future date. All right. House members, thank you for participating. Thank you for your...
Mr. Chair,
we're going to... Well, it's all right. No, it's fine. We've only got a couple. By my reckoning, we have the little bit of direction, if possible, on the OPI piece, the assisted living piece, the sleep data center, and the MMIS. We'd be done. There's another meeting scheduled, Mr. Chairman, at 6:30. So we'll go right to 6:30, so how far we get. Revisiting the Oregon Project Independence, is there a great heartburn with the department's recommendation at this point in time? We can always revisit this in June.
Are we just chit-chatting, or are we making decisions absent a quorum?
No, we're trying to get some direction at least to start with, and I can confer with the co-chair and the other members.
You're referring, Mr. Co-chair, to the $400,000?
Yes. That is correct.
Just saying that's being directed to the SBA, to the SPA.
The SPA.
And that's how you're putting this $400,000 into the special purpose appropriation.
Yeah, Mr. Britton.
I'm sorry, Mr. Co-Chair, I didn't hear the question, Senator Nelson.
This money is being redirected to the special purpose appropriation. I mean, it's...
Yes, Mr.
Trying
Co-Chair.
To flexibility. That's part
that's
of
the idea. Senator Whitson has a question.
I do. I'm still struggling with the concept of taking approximately $30 million from SBDC and putting it in the special appropriations budget, with the expectation that $30 million from that special appropriation budget is going to go back to SBDC. It seems to me, and I'm a novice with this budget, but it seems to me that the likelihood is there will be a significant disappropriation over the course of this time for SBDC.
Fine. Ms. Baker can help us out.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the $31 million reduction in the SPD budget. In the original rebalance plan, about half of that was related to the change in the federal match rate. So that's a technical budget change in terms of general fund, federal fund split, but there's no programmatic impact. So it's not, in effect, pulling $15 or $16 million out of the SPD budget in terms of services. About $10 million of that appeared to be from caseload reductions, so the projected caseloads are not as high as they were expected to be. Again, there's no program impact from that, so that may make you have a little more context for the $31 million reduction, that it's not a sense of programs were reduced in the SPD budget and now dollars are going into the special purpose appropriation as a result of those programmatic reductions. It was a change in the federal match rate and a change in the forecast that resulted in most of those reductions.
Okay, I think I understand part of that for me.
Of course.
In my district, we don't have fewer seniors or fewer people that are disabled, so why has there been a significant reduction in that caseload? Are we not serving them or what?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, it appeared in looking at the rebalance detail that there were several pieces of that. The senior and people with disabilities budget includes seniors, it includes developmental disability services, and I believe home care workers was a piece of that as well. So it's not that there are fewer seniors or fewer people in need, it's that relative to the original budget forecast, which was funded at the end of session, that program forecast is expected to be down. So it doesn't address need per se, but it's as a budgeting tool, when we budget compared to the forecast, if the forecast goes up, generally more money's added in. Forecast goes down, money comes out of the budget. But it doesn't affect on the ground the level of funding or the number of people that are actually receiving funding. It's against the forecast. That makes may have confused it more, but
it certainly did.
What I'm saying is the budget is based on an estimate of how many people will be served over the biennium. If when they start getting actuals in terms of number of people served, and that forecast then changes either upwards or downwards, then the budget changes relative to that forecast.
More questions, concerns on LFO's recommendation for OPI? All right, good. Let's move to the assisted living facilities. The original LFO recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, did we skip over Medicaid Management Information System? I'm just going down the.
Let's go to the next one shortly.
The sheet I have as this one is the next. Assisted living facilities. Am I confusing members?
No, it's just the dog. He's had a hard day.
So the LFO recommendation originally was to support the DHS proposal to make the 9.7 general fund allocation, but to unschedule that money until the department could come in after talking with the industry and have some agreements about increasing industry-wide participation in Medicaid long-term care program. And then with the forecast going down dramatically, the department has changed its recommendation and saying, well, we still want that information, but maybe we should put it all in the SPA, the SPA, and maybe revisit this in June. So do we have a sense of what the Senate would like to do in that regard?
You know, you and I and others have been down this road before. And just a testimony, as I heard from Mr. Carlson, that there is an issue of providers, some who have already left the contracts with the state because of this overrate issue. We don't know how many more in the future will decide to not provide the service. And so, you know, with me, it's like it's another one of those issues that we talked about similar with the state hospital. We have a situation where I think we need to provide some provision that gives some assurance to the industry that, in fact, they will have a rate adjustment. We can't continue to lose facilities and have no place to go, where seniors have no place to go. And that's one of my concerns.
Good concern. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Excuse me for losing my place a minute ago. For the first time, not for the last. The other problem with this is even though the revenue forecast has gone down, the problem we're faced with here hasn't changed, unfortunately, and that's a sad part of it. I asked a few of the people in my area what this meant, and I talked to two of them that are, lower, that are not taking more Medicaid patients, and where are those Medicaid patients going to go? And my concern is they're going to go to nursing homes. Mm-hmm. And that's going to cost two or three times what the state has to pay now in these assisted living facilities of all types. And so from my point of view, I know this is still a good consideration, and you're still negotiating, but bottom line is we need some reassurance that we're not going to be losing more Medicaid beds because we really can't afford to. It'll come back and we'll have to pay more in the long run. In the long run, it isn't far away. We're talking 5, 6, 7 months away if we don't take care of this. So I don't know where exactly that number is, mm-hmm. that we stop losing Medicaid beds and people stay open. And it may vary in different parts of the state also, but we have to have some idea where that's at. Maybe LFO can help us with it. Maybe nobody knows for sure. Certainly we need to put something aside here and finish your negotiations.
Okay. Good comment. Senator Carter.
Mr. Chairman, my colleagues are right, and I support the direction in which they appear to be going, and that is that no matter what the forecast is, we either have to make a decision to send people to nursing homes at a higher cost or stabilize the industry that the ALFs so that we can have lower cost availability of beds available to us. And so for me, I would like to see this money allocated so that we can be about the business of showing dignity to our elderly in this state.
Very good. Senator Nelson.
This thing,
You know, the last sentence of that thing says it would generate about $650 a month of general fund savings. I mean, how many months? I just don't have enough information to be really comfortable with this. And the public testimony seemed to indicate that we would actually be costing more money. I think that's what the previous comments have been saying. So I just need some more information here to kind of figure out, you know, where are the savings and where's the best place for us to go.
Okay. Senator Berger.
Just to give you a little bit of a rural perspective, the Spencer House closed in the Lincoln City area, and that particular company owned 17 other facilities in Oregon, and they were going to close all of them to anybody except private pay. And the problem is in rural Oregon is that then we have to drive for miles inland to the valley, and many of these families don't have the kind of wherewithal to have the gasoline to go and visit these people on a regular basis. So it is a very serious situation in rural Oregon.
Very good. Well, it sounds like we have general consensus, at least on the Senate side, that we can short-circuit the discussion. We have to come back with our House members, because they'll get a chance to discuss, that we want to do the allocation more similar to the original LFO recommendation, get a report maybe on how they're going to do the Medicaid population that Senator Berger's talking about, but go ahead with the allocation and not hold that in the special purpose appropriation. So that's my sense of what I mean. Okay, that's good enough. Now we get to, state data center charges. Anyone have a problem saving $500,000? Might have been a little bit of a lead-in question.
Can we get more?
I'd rather save half a million.
Where's me? Okay, so I don't see much discussion there. The MMIS system. This is a tough question, because if we delay what we've been trying to get to for many, many biennia, we save $9 or $10 million. If we delay it, it doesn't mean we delay it forever. It could be delayed till June. The providers won't like it. You will hear from the providers. They would prefer to get paid instantaneously rather than in 90 days, as I would in my business. What's the sense of the body here? This is a savings, folks. Yes.
Can I ask a big question?
Question is, John.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. John, the claims payment system we're talking about here, is this for physicians and nurse practitioners, or is it in hospitals, or does it include durable medical goods? Is it assisted living facilities? How wide is this claims we're talking about? What kind of system we're looking at?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Bates, I'm not certain of the answer to that question. My belief is that it is fairly widespread. For any provider that has the electronic payment or signs up for it and has the means to make that connection, I would note that this money is both in health services, so it is probably for physicians and hospitals and the like, but it is also in the seniors and people with disabilities, so that any of those providers that can sign up for this electronic claims payment system would also be affected. And I would add something to what Co-Chair Schrader said, and that was, again, there is a federal issue here as well. There is some risk, and I don't know how big a risk it is, but the federal government has been paying 90% of the cost for getting this MMIS system up to speed. They probably will have objections if we are delaying this particular element. Whether that means penalties, I can't tell you that. I don't know the answer to that one.
Our comment, if I could, Mr. Co-Chair, and I know half our board is missing here. The system that most physicians, at least, are on, electronic for state, is amazingly and surprisingly one of the best we ever use. It's better than the commercial carriers. Most time the payments are quick and on time, and we don't have a major problem. That may not be true everywhere else. I also wonder if this is just for the fee-for-service patients, or is it just for, or does it include managed care? And I'd like to see an idea of sort of our size of this thing from the provider's point of view. Is 90% of it with physicians and hospitals, or is that 10%? It makes a big difference. And considering our budget restraints now because of falling revenue, and when I look at $9 million, and we're looking at cutting SSAs, and we're talking about money for Medicaid beds, for a system that I think we can live with for a little bit longer, my sense is to take this money and use it for other parts of the budget right now. The feds are our good friends and always helpful to us, I realize. They're always there for us in times of need, and so maybe we can ask them to be there again for us. See, I'm going to be sarcastic like you are. But I would ask for more information on this. We make a little more rational decision, but my sense is this is something we might delay for up to a year till we know what our budget forecasts, revenue forecasts are, and take care of some real needs for people, SSAs for foster children, and our demand for more Medicaid beds for our elderly. I'd rather put the money there than a new computer system.
Senator Johnson and Senator Berger.
With your indulgence, Mr. Co-Chair, I would certainly like to take advantage of Mr. Scherzinger's presence in the room, given that he has been trying so hard to regularize many of the payments in and out of DHS, and I would just appreciate his comments on us delaying this system in terms of how to have more predictability in DHS's overall budgeting.
Please come forward. Thank you for saying. We're hoping we ask this question.
I know,
I'm Jim Scherzinger, Deputy Director, Department of Human Services. I think there's sort of two sides to this question, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson. On the one hand, I think this is an issue that if we delayed this portion of the system, that the federal government would have a pretty serious issue with us. We're already on a kind of a difficult conversation with them about getting this system implemented by the schedule that we had, and to purposely choose to not put in part of a system which they view to both save money, because what this web portal part of the system does is it allows the provider to enter information in and get immediate feedback on whether or not their claim is met, is been input correctly. So they can do whatever correction they need to do right there in order to fix it and get it in. That's one of the ways that it speeds it up. It also saves money on the other end on administrative costs, because we don't have to deal with errors in the system. They fix them before it gets in. And so because they, as I said, as John said, they're funding 90% of the cost of the system, and they pay the majority of the administration of the system, that they're going to want to know, if they're not going to get this administrative savings that they expect to get, how we're going to pay them back for that. And so I do think we're going to be in a conversation, if we delay it, that will potentially eat away at the potential one-time savings that we would get from not putting a system in. So I think that's the one side. I do think that when we've made this estimate, that it's toward the high end of the possibilities. And in other words, that it's assuming that most people would use this part of the system, and that may not be the case, and especially may not be the case when, you know, at that portion of what really matters isn't what happens right away. It's what happens right at the end of the biennium, when how many people are using it at the end of the biennium, because it's those costs that will come forward into the current biennium. So I think as we put the system in, we'll get better data on how many people are using this capacity, and the estimate might come down as to what its cost would be. Now, having said that, I do think we have to recognize that the only reason this is an issue at all is that we don't account for our costs in Medicaid appropriately. We're not accruing costs like everybody else is accruing them. And if we were accruing costs like other people were, this wouldn't even be in front of you, because we would be counting costs when those costs are incurred and not waiting until we're paying for things to accrue them. So, but, you know, that's, we are here today, and it's in front of us because of that. And so I do think there's, as I said, potentially some reduction in the amount that would be incurred here. I'd hate to be the person that has to get into that conversation with the federal government over not imposing the system that they paid for.
So let me ask a question, though, Mr. Scherzinger. If this is such a critical item, how come it wasn't in our 07-09 budget?
Mr. Co-Chair, we got to this issue from the accrual side, and we identified for the upcoming budget that we had an accrual issue of somewhere around $60 million. The judgment was made that, in other words, we needed a one-time general fund appropriation of somewhere in the range of $60 million in order to cover our cash flow issues and for properly accruing these expenditures. And the judgment was made at that time that we weren't going to get $60 million to do that. To be honest about it, we didn't really think of that some of that cost we were going to have to eat no matter what, because this system was going to create that additional efficiency. It's only when we started talking in rebalance about, well, let's try to figure out a way to cover some of this accrual. We had sort of, before we went into the budget, we said that we had even talked not to this committee, but to your prior committees about our cash flow issues. And the notion we came away with from those meetings is that we would try to manage our way toward covering the accrual issues. And so we didn't put it into the budget. And it's only when we started to really think in detail about how we were going to manage it that the question came up, was, you know, if we put this MMIS system in, we're going to have to eat some of these costs now. We don't have a choice about it. And so, to be honest about it, we didn't think of it when the budget was proposed.
That's fine. Senator Whitsitt and Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Coach Schrader. I know you inherited this problem, so this isn't directed at you necessarily, but, you know, in the private sector, if you hide $60 million in expenses by accounting sleight of hand, you go to prison. And that appears to be essentially what has happened in the past with DHS. The question is, for this $10 million investment of the taxpayers' money, how much, what is the projected savings to DHS on an annualized basis?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the portion of it that is related to administrative costs, which is what this would save. I mean, there are other elements of the MMIS system that that are related to other elements of the system that we will put in, regardless of what decision is made on the web portal. But my understanding is that somewhere around a total savings of $2 million from efficiencies, most of which would go back to the federal government because they're paying those costs now. So in other words, if we reduce our administrative costs of administering the Medicaid system, since they're participating, what is it, 75% of those costs is what they pay?
It's 60.
No, but that's on the program side. On the administrative side of administering the Medicaid system, I think most of those cost savings accrue back to them. And that's why if we don't get those savings, they'll be talking to us about why we're not imposing the system.
So if I understand, then the $10 million investment from Oregon would be about 40% of the total investment, the other part coming from the federal government, so we might expect to save 20% of that $2 million a year?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Witt, I don't think you can think of it that way. This cost is a timing cost. It's not a real cost. It's the cost of recognizing. The costs are still the same, and it's just recognizing them in a different period of time.
I understand.
And so it's not an investment I don't think you can think of it as an investment. It's simply recognizing a cost in a different period of time than you would otherwise. And I think it would drive you nuts to try to think of it as an investment that gets a payoff.
Follow up?
So essentially, through the difference in cash and accrual accounting, the DHS has carried forward this deficit and then an accrual basis without admitting that they owe the debt. Is that correct?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think it is correct. The only thing that I would shade it a bit is that we do accrue properly for financial statement purposes, which is what you can go to jail for if you don't do that right. For budget purposes, it is your choice as to how you want to do it. And it's because you are the managers of the budget.
The analogy was in the private sector.
That's right.
Okay. Senator Johnson, I'll ask him, then we probably should vacate the room for the other committee.
Mr. Chair?
I'm going to hold things. Senator Winters. All right, well, thank you very much. Appreciate that, because the other group will want to have the same discussion. I think there's no point in going over that. Well, let's then recess or adjourn our work session here for today. Thank you for bearing with us, Senators. Good questions.